Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 13, unlucky for some, of the Carpcast. Is it unlucky for you, Mark?
Well, I hope not, although it's going to be put out on, it's episode 13, released on a Friday. Not the 13th, but...
I was going to say, that would have been rather freaky.
Yeah. But I'm not superstitious in any way, shape or form. The only gods I recognise are the Carp gods, and they've been given to both of us.
Yeah, we both had some fish this week, which is nice. Although, do you pray to the carp gods ever?
I don't pray to them, but I show my middle finger and curse them every now and then when they shit on me from a great height.
They do give and they do take. They gave you this week then. Tell us what's happened.
Yeah, another session down at Highcombe. Usual Sunday after work. Got down there. It was about 5 o'clock, a little bit later than normal. But that's because I spent the hour as soon as I got home interviewing Lee Birch.
Cool. Yeah, he's going to be a guest on the next show, not this one. We've got one in the bank because this show is a special American edition, isn't it?
Yeah, I spoke to three of the leading American carpers and, well, listen to it later on in the show. It's very interesting and certainly opened my eyes a bit. They are... Well, all I'll say is now that carp are a hell of a lot more widespread in America than what I thought, and they are just scratching the surface with the pioneering to do over there.
Yeah, I guess they're fairly nuisance fish, aren't they, over there? And two of the guys are English, aren't they? So they kind of learned their carping over here with our methods and then moved to America, didn't they?
They did, yeah. That's Ian Sorrell and Dean Brooks, who... both heavily involved, and the other fella I spoke to was a fella called David Moore. Not the gruff Yorkshire bloke, but an American chap. You know, he runs a big tackle shop over there, and he's also involved heavily in the carp scene and promoting it. And anyway, I don't want to give too much away. The chat's come on later on.
Cool. So, yeah, Highcombe, your session?
Yeah, I got down there. I'd have my usual drive round. But what I usually do, I drive down there. I've already got a picture in my mind of where I want to be, so I'll purposely drive in the other end. So I'm looking at the entire lake rather than just going straight to where I think of. So I got in there, drove in the other end, drove straight round and set up in the swim I was thinking of.
That worked.
It did. But, well, it did work. I had three fish.
Cool, yep. It's... Have you had pretty much all the fish recently from the same spots?
No.
You've been moving around.
Yeah, the first fish I had, which I was quite lucky with my first fish, it was my biggie so far, 32. That was from one end of the lake, they're called Bypass End, which would be the west end. My next run of fish, they were from three different swims, but at the opposite side of that end. Then these latest three... if she were to walk from the swim I fished to the swim I had six out of, you'd have walked a mile.
Nice.
So it's quite a swim move, but I'm happy. It gives you a bit of satisfaction not to keep doing the same thing, to try something, try a different area in this case. You know, same rigs. I'm now on my little multi-rig, 18 hooked and 18 landed this year.
Yeah, that's a decent record. That's a really good record.
Yeah, I'm not into plugging products anymore. I'm out of the out of the media game when we start doing this. But the picture I put up on the Carpcast Facebook page a few weeks back is the exact rig I'm using, and I put it up there to hopefully try and help people out because it works and it nails them. The only thing I'd add, if you're going to use that rig, get the forceps ready.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point with the rigs.
Yeah.
So I went fishing as well, decided to get down and see Nathan on Cromwell, which is probably the most regular place I've fished this year, where I haven't been doing loads, and it's mainly been day tickets, and it's quite easy down there, and it was even easier because I'd left my gear there from the week before when I was just sleeping down there when I was playing poker in Nottingham and just kipping in Cromwell at nights because it was saving a one or a night on a hotel. So my gear was already there. I couldn't really go anywhere else. So I kind of had to drive down there and then got in peg 14, which is the left-hand side of Willow Point.
Yeah.
Where you had a couple from the week before, was it?
Yep, I'm going to take some credit for your captures after you phoned me up and I told you exactly where to fish.
You said 26 wraps at the tree. I couldn't get a bite off that rod. I'd finished up with 6 takes and a catfish, and I reeled in at 11:30 every night because the action was just too much for me, not being used to catching fish this year. I was more worried about my sleep. But yeah, I was actually catching left of the willow and 25 wraps. I was on like, there's like a Christmas tree shaped tree, like a triangular tree to the left on the caravan horizon. And just left of that, there's another tree that's on the kind of waterline. It's on that second tree, the waterline one. But it's right between two lights on the caravan park at night, so it's pretty easy for getting it back out there. But yeah, I had all the takes on that rod. I couldn't get a bite on the willow, going a bit longer and sort of over the back of the weed. It was bumping down nicer. It was bumping down rock hard, and the bit that you said, but I just couldn't get a bite off it.
That's interesting, because it was quite soft for me.
No, it's rock hard there now, but it's softer to the left where I was catching, or a little bit softer. But yeah, I still not had a 30 out of Cromwell. I must have had, I don't know, 35 fish out there now in total, over quite a few sessions. One fish in four is a 30 on there. I've seen people have 4 30s in a row, you know, one after the other. I've witnessed it a number of times. And I've still not had one. It was my PB Cromwell carp, or just under 28 pound, cracking mirror. But yeah, I just kept catching the low to mid 20s. The guy next to me in 15 had a great session. One guy had moved off, and another guy came on. I hadn't fished for 2 years, and he was catching them all in the daytimes, and I was catching at night. As soon as it went dark, and that's why I didn't kind of leave the rods out, because I valued my sleep. But if the action was in the day, I'd have been more than happy to fish as hard as I could, get as many takes. But he was catching the daytime. He had like 4 bites on his first day, and then he was catching the morning after as well. He was getting them from first light all day till it went dark. And as soon as it went dark, I was catching out the deeper water. Literally the second the sun dropped, I was catching. And I'm just sure that, you know, he's fishing in 5 foot. It's what? I didn't actually plumb it, but what is it, 10, 11 foot out there where we were fishing?
Yeah, I didn't plumb it. I just felt the lead down out there, and I'm going to guess between 12 and 15. Right, well, look on the map that Nathan's had done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we could. I'd say it's nearer 12 and 15. I don't think there's many 15 in there at all. But anyway, yeah, I'm sure they were just moving out into the deeper water as soon as the sun went down.
Yeah,
and because he didn't have a bleep overnight, not one night.
Yeah, my 2 fish from there were at night. From that swim.
Makes total sense. I've caught in there before at night. I've caught in there at tea time as well. But I've had fish out off that willow in the past. It's 14 and 15, the 2 pegs I've never blanked in. Never blanked in either of them.
Right, that's one good thing with the Icon fishing this year. I've had 15 carp out there this year, and only one has been at night. The rest have been a couple in the evening, and the rest are like 7 o'clock in the morning to midday.
Yeah, no, that's good. Before we move on, we can haul ourselves out a little bit. Speaking of Cromwell.
Yes, the Carpcast has its first official sponsor. So I'd like to thank Helen and Nathan of Cromwell Lakes for sponsoring episode 12. Let me tell you a bit about Cromwell Lakes. There's 18 acres with 18 swims. This is including a large disabled swim. There's an angler's lodge offering charging points, fridge freezer, clean toilets, free showers, a seated area inside and out. There's an on-site tackle shop stocked with terminal tackle and bait, including mainline and sticky baits. The car park is secure behind a locked gate. Nets, mats and slings are provided. But this is where it starts to get really impressive when we talk about the stock of carp. They are approaching 60 £30 plus fish and 7 known 40s. All in a Midlands day ticket venue. Prices start at £30 for 24 hours with discounts for longer stays.
If you want to contact Cromwell Lakes, you can follow them on Twitter, at Cromwell Lake. You can search for them on Facebook. You can check out their website, which is cromwelllake.com, or give Nathan a ring. You can speak to him on 07816 243 023. And you might even see me and Jamie down there.
And also, the Northern Angling Show 4 is in preparation now. The early bird tickets are on sale. They're limited to 500, and I think there's 300 and something gone already. The benefit of buying an early bird one is you get a free £9.99 value bookazine, which is sent out to you after you buy the ticket. You don't get that with the when the tickets go on general sale. You won't be getting that. So it's I think there's like 100 and something left of the early birds. You can get them from northernanglingshow.co.uk. Or you can find us on our Facebook page. I think there's a ticket link on there. Loads of new companies as well as everybody else last year. I mean, we sold out the space last year. And we had 7,500 people. We're going for the 10,000 people this year over the 2 days. And there's a lot of big new companies signed up. I don't think I'm allowed to say because they're all getting launched in the September general sale ticket launch. But I can tell you now there's some fantastic big companies that haven't attended previously that that are on for this year. So northernanglingshow.co.uk. And if you buy anything off Amazon ever, please use the link. It gets us a couple of pence if you use the link that's in our in the notes underneath or on our Facebook page pinned to the top, which is the Carpcast on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. If you want to speak to me or Mark directly, you can do it on Facebook or Twitter. I'm at Dustitute. Like prostitute, but with dust instead of prost. At
that
dust-itute.
Needs an explanation.
I'm not sure I can say. Not sure I can say it on the air. It's the name. It came from the name that when I used to make records or dance tracks, house tracks. If you search dustitutes on SoundCloud, you'll probably find some of them, or Beatport, or TrackSource, which are like the DJs kind of. Music sites, if you search Dustitutes on either of them, you can actually buy some of our tracks. A few of them got signed. But, yeah, that was the name of our production duo, as we called it, me and this other guy. And I've used it for everything. It's my poker aliases. It's my Twitter name, at Dustitute. Or, obviously, the Carpcast on Twitter. Just Google. Yeah. You can even Google Jamie Clossick, Mark Watson, the Carpcast. You'll find us. Wherever you want to social media stalkers, you can do it.
And we will endeavour to respond, especially to the Carpcast Facebook page. That is quite active.
Yeah, so we had any questions or anything on there?
We probably have. I've skimped on the notes a bit because we've got so much time is going to be taken up by the interviews on this one. I think what we're going to do for the next one, the Lee Birch one, we'll open it up to questions again and, well, for a big collective of questions.
Yeah. Oh, guess what? We're recording. We record once every 2 weeks and the neighbour's dogs decide it's going to scream again because I never hear it unless we're recording. I can hear it bounding through my headphones.
I'm not hearing him this end, so.
All right, okay. He's like squealing. Bad. It's a high pitch, like someone's trodden his tail. It's that kind of noise.
Here we go. The Carpcast page. I put a picture on there this week of just the swim I was in, saying, just caught one. That usually means I'm about to break something. And fortunately, the only thing I did break was wind. But I'm just looking at a reply here from a chap called Alan Tring. 3 hours into a 48-hour session, carp gods giveth. And he's holding up a cracking common. He doesn't say weight, but it's a cracking fish. And then his next post, 4 hours into the same session, the carp gods taketh away. And he's busted his brolly. So it's not just us. It happens to everybody. The carp gods are cruel masters.
I've seen something on the net.
It's on the net. It must be true.
That's quite relevant to stuff we've been talking about. We've been talking about Periscope quite a bit, the live streaming from the bank and stuff. Not that I've done much recently because all my stuff was at night on Cromwell and I did intend I made sure I got up at first light every day and put the rods back out to try and sneak a take before it got properly light and they just didn't want to feed in the daylight in my peg otherwise I would have periscoped some stuff but Facebook is taking on the Periscope market If you didn't know, I don't know if you've seen it yet, it's very new. It's called Facebook Mentions. I think currently it's for celebrities. It lets celebrities stream live video, which sounds like it's a Periscope copy. But for people that use Facebook a hell of a lot more than Twitter, me being one of those, then I'm interested to see how it develops and whether it is just for celebrity accounts or if anyone can do it. But it's called Facebook Mentions. I'm pretty sure if you can link one to a business page, then we will get a Carpcast Facebook page mentioned. So keep your eye on that. We'll see if it's an app or look into it this week.
Yeah, I'm going to keep an eye out for that one. And if it is starting with just the celebrities, I'm sure that will be just the start, and they will, well, they've got to compete with Periscope, so they will roll it out to all as mortals.
Yeah, I'm just reading an article on the net now, and it says it's a new streaming feature for VIP users who have access to Mentions, the Facebook app that caters to public figures. So, yeah, it sounds like it is just public figures at the minute.
Here's one thing that I thought of this week. Early on, we pretty much predicted the live streaming Periscope thing. I'm going to make another prediction. And I was listening to some random podcast this week. They were talking about 3D printing.
Yeah.
So, how long before you can walk into your tackle shop, put your money in a machine, and it'll 3D print you some lead clips or some beads or whatever you want?
I wouldn't walk into a tackle shop. I mean, it's going to kill tackle shops. So I've been following the sort of development of 3D printers for years now. And you'll basically download the... You remember years ago, I mean, I remember from when I was a kid, my mum, like, they used to buy in, like, knitting patterns. You'd go and buy a pattern for a jumper, and then you get it home and copy it, you know, make your own stuff. My mum and my sister used to make stuff. You basically... For the 3D printers, you buy the pattern, the design for whatever it, you know, everybody will have a 3D printer in their own house. So instead of going to the shop, you're just going to buy the pattern offline, online, and make it yourself. At the minute, they mainly doing plastic molded stuff, but it's essentially what these 3D printers do. I mean, you can make guns yourself. There's plans online, and I've seen news articles of confiscated weapons that have been made. But you know, by criminal gangs that have bought a 3D printer. Obviously, it's the cheapest 3D printer is about $5,000 at the minute, pounds. They're going to be, if you look at electrical equipment that was $5,000 when it first came out, that, you know, TVs and stuff, you know, widescreen plasmas, you know, you can buy for £120 now. It's not going to be too long before everybody has a 3D printer in the house. So you won't be going into the tackle shop. You'll be downloading the plans direct from Nash. If you want a Nash lead clip, or if you want a corder, this, that, or the other, you'll bang it into your own 3D printer and make it. There will be no shopping, and it's going to happen in my lifetime, and I'm old.
Yeah, you're older than me, I'm glad to say.
It's actually my birthday on Friday. Send all money to me.
Wow, Jamie Klosick's 50th.
not quite. No, I shall be having a large party on my 50th now, but I think, I'm not 100% sure, because I actually gained a year the other year. I was convinced that I was 40 that year, and I wasn't. I was 39, which was an extremely happy year. I felt I lived every day like it was my last. But now, 43 this year, I think. Yeah, well, on Friday.
Yeah, come the end of this year, I will be turning 40. And the way I'm feeling about at the minute, when I actually turn 30, depression set in. It's like I'm not in my 20s, I'm not a kid anymore. Then I'm now in 40s, and then, well, excuse the, well, the French, but no Fs are given. I could not care less. You know, if I cared what people think, I'd have cut my hair off a long time ago.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Have you got a top knot, though?
No. I have a traditional old ponytail, and I still let it down and bang my head to Slayer.
Cool.
When no one's watching.
Anything else you've seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Yeah, this is something that is going to crop up again and again and again. Death rigs. Steve Bug, he's the bailiff on Bayswater. He's posted up some pictures of rigs that have been caught in the day ticket lake there, and this is what he's had to say. Over the past few weeks, anglers on the day ticket have been experiencing false takes. We now believe carp are towing lead core leaders. We have a no Ledco leader or any other type of leaders ruling on the lake, so this should not be happening. Two leaders were retrieved this week, with a 17-pound mirror on one looking very lean and tired. We will not tolerate this, and rig checks will now be taking place.
Yeah, it's... I mean, day ticket lakes are susceptible to this. The only way around it, you cater for the lowest common denominator, you're going to have to do rig checks. I remember when we fished Luke Moffitt's place in France. He's known for being quite strict on everything, but I thought he was fair. His rules are logical, as an aside. But, you know, he comes round before you start fishing and checks your rigs, checks that your leads drop off, everything. And he leaves you alone after that. And there's nothing worse than having your rods out and have some bailiff, especially, you know, some people like being in charge of people. You know, some people like being a dick when they have a bit of power. It's unfortunately, it's a human trait that human beings don't like being told what to do by other human beings, number one, and there are certain human beings that get a kick out of having power over other human beings, and unfortunately some bailiffs are a little bit like that. Must have been bullied at school, or most are okay, but I've come across a few people that I'm not particularly fond of. But you know, it's the old power trip thing. It's like I'm rambling now, but it's like, have you ever worked in like a place where, like a warehouse or something, where everyone's in the same boat? You know, you're all doing the same job, order picking, wheeling your sack truck around all day, doing stuff. And then one of the lads that's kind of, you know, worked with you for 2 years gets promoted to supervisor and all of a sudden turns into a complete and utter wanker overnight. You know, oh, yeah. I've seen it a number of times. You know, give somebody a bit of power and all of a sudden this guy that has been your pal for 2 years is now a dick.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And, well, there's one fella we used to work with. I'll just refer to him as the Bav. I'm not going to say his proper name, that'd be unfair, but the Bav, it stood for Born Again Virgin. A nickname he earned after, well, just being fat, ugly, disgusting and single. And, you know, yeah, the muscles on his right arm were strangely bigger than his left. I know exactly what you mean.
And unfortunately, there are some people, you know, some guys that, you know, if you give a decent guy some power, he's not going to turn into a dick. But if you give some people, especially the, I mean, who was it who said, it's a famous quote about anybody who wants to be in power probably shouldn't be. It was one of the American presidents, I think, not Jimmy Carter, one of the early ones. It's basically, if you want power, then you're probably not the right person to have it. But anyway, unfortunately, some bailiffs are a little bit like, you know, the plastic policemen, the people that want to not good enough to be a real copper, and so decide to be one of the pretend ones. And so I'm going to see how many people I can upset in a five minute rant on a podcast. I'm pretty sure I've pissed off half of our listeners already.
I think it's quite entertaining. If we want to piss people off, to say we've got enough rope to hang ourselves, but we're swinging it a bit.
We're trying.
Let's get back to death rigs.
We do start saying that we're opinionated at the start of the podcast. We kind of give a disclaimer that we are going to be annoying. Unfortunately, some bailiffs are on that little power trip. Most are great. Some have that little power trip, and they can make your life hell. If you're sat there fishing and somebody doesn't like you, whatever, this bailiff guy's got a bee in his bonnet about you because maybe he's got a green-eyed monster because you've caught a fish, or maybe he thinks you get free bait or sponsored and he's a bit jealous, or maybe he wishes he had the time you had to fish. And, you know, I've come across all those situations where they want to make your life a misery. And if you have a rig checking rule, you know, and they tip up just on dark when your rods are set for bite time and stuff, and they're like, right, reel in, want to check your rigs, you know, then it can cause problems. Like I say, these people we've just described, I have witnessed them do that, and they're doing it deliberately on bite times, deliberately when they've just watched you put your rods out from the other side of the lake, get everything sorted, then they come round and ask you. But I have no problem whatsoever with somebody checking all my tackle when I first set up, and I think they should do. You know, if I ran a day ticket lake, I would have measures in place to make sure people are using the correct rigs. Yeah, there's nothing to stop them changing it, you know, but a little walk round when somebody's landing a fish, you know, if somebody catches a little wander past as they're landing it, you know, is not intrusive and can make sure they're still sticking to the rigs that you checked at the start of the session. But I do think on dating lakes, you kind of have to. Look, obviously, Gary, who owns Bayswater, and Steve are great guys, and they're going to have to clamp down on this because, you know, the fish do come first.
Without a doubt. And if I did run a day ticket water, or even a syndicate, to be honest, the first thing I would ban would be lead core or any sort of leader. It would be tubing. That was it.
Yeah, and as somebody who uses leaders, I mean, lead core in the right hands is no problem whatsoever. I don't think I've ever left a lead core leader attached to a fish in 15 years of using lead core. Pretty sure I haven't. I don't crack off. If a, you know, I do have to fish long range, I use the correct leaders. It's rare. You know, if you're doing it right, I mean, yes, sometimes crack offs. You know, if you're doing casting demos, you try wallop it as far as you can. You haven't got a hook bait on usually anyway. So it's unusual to put a, unless you're having to fish extreme distance. I know on Stone Acres, before they allowed you to drop from boats, when they were casting, you know, and you had to cast 150 yards regularly, I know there was a hell of a lot of cut-offs and crack-offs and fish towing stuff back then, which, you know, I'm glad they put the, you know, allowed you to drop from boats and eggs. It's got to be better for the fish than everybody struggling to try and reach the bars and stuff and inevitably cracking off when you're having to put four rods out at that sort of range.
Yeah, definitely. But I think before we move on from death rigs, for those people listening who are new to carping, who are wondering what the hell we're talking about, basically a death rig is a fixed lead rig. So if you crack off or your line cracks above, the theory is the carp, should it pick your rig up and get hooked, should be able to get rid of the lead, whatever setup you're using, so it is not towing it round and risking getting tethered by picking up loads of weed or getting stuck in a snag.
Yeah, and the problem with lead core is because of its kind of stiff nature, if you crack off, but the one reason why some people don't like lead core, and if I had a day ticket lake, I wouldn't allow lead core, is because if you snap at the where the lead core joins your main line, all it needs is a kink in the lead core, and you know, it's difficult for anything to slide over it anyway. It also tends to pick up weed and stuff. So I've pulled death rigs in on lakes in the past where the lead's gone. If you've got like a fixed lead clip that, like the Nashi weed clips or the quarter clips or anything, they're one that's fixed to the swivel. So, like, the actual lead clip can't slide, and then the lead has no option but to slip off. I've pulled in fish like that have been tethered and are really badly injured, where there is no lead, but the lead core itself at the other end of it has picked up weed and just got heavier and heavier. So it's like having a pound of weight on the end of the lead core, which is just like a lead sliding down it. Well, it's worse because it's probably heavier than a 3-ounce lead.
Well, maybe not that heavy, but certainly heavy. And one thing I will say, and this is me being opinionated now, you've had your turn. There is absolutely no reason whatsoever why anyone should be using lengths of lead core, anything above a couple of feet. And to be honest, anglers in magazines are advocating the uses of 5 and 6 foot lengths are downright irresponsible.
Yeah, I seem to remember one very well-known angler whose name we shan't mention. It was a lot longer than that he was using. It was almost the full length of the rod. And there is no need. I mean, if you've been out in a boat and looked, especially on a weedy lake, looked at how that lead core lies, it doesn't. I mean, my preferred leader now, I mean, this is the debate. Like, if I had a day ticket late, I'd certainly ban lead core, and I'd probably ban most leaders unless it was a lot of short range fishing, because it's unlikely somebody's going to crack off. If it's a 5-acre day ticket lake, then probably not. But leaders, I mean, at the end of the day, somebody's tying a knot to their swivel anyway. What's one extra knot to a leader? Especially the ready-made leaders that have loops in them, you know, the corded ones, the Ash diffusion ones. There's a few companies that do them.
Yeah, to be honest, I think they're as bad. I've actually reverted back to using tubing myself now, just because a couple of fish that I've caught from Icom, they've had weed, and the weed has got knotted around the top of the leader I've been using, which is one of the lead-free ones, and that it makes netting them quite difficult. So that's the reason I've done it, and that's while it's still attached.
I have lost fish with tubing now, where the tubing slid up. I mean, I've got tubing on now because that's what I used on Cromwell, because I think they have no leaders on there as well. And I had tubing on. I was on Wireside the week before as well, and that's definitely tubing only. So I've got, I use the tungsten tubing, just a little, like, I don't know, 18-inch length. And to be honest, that looks great on the bottom, and I'm happy using it. The only thing I don't like on Weedy Lakes is when the tubing slides up, and part of the benefit of using a leader is that it's tougher just above the lead, which is the bit that's most susceptible to snapping when you're in thick weed. So obviously when the line's grating through weed, if you're pulling the fish back and forwards, when you're using tubing, the tubing can slide up the line, and then it's your bare line at its most vulnerable spot. Basically, like the test you did, you know, rubbing line on a brick, the abrasion test, you're essentially doing that in weed, because weed's rough, especially if there's little shells in it and stuff. And I think you lose more fish with tubing on weedy waters.
Yeah, possibly. But then again, it does make it easier to land them. In the last, well, the first one I had this week, because it was when I changed, you know, I just like literally scoop it up like a blooming salmon, and actually netted it, you know, a couple of foot down. I'm stood with my knees up to water at the edge of the shelf, looking down, thinking one more step and it's going to be tickling between my legs, which I really don't need. That's why I changed anyway. And if you cast your mind back when we were fishing Elstow 1, that was tubing only, and guess what? We caught fish, and lots of them.
Yeah, there wasn't. There was only one peg that had a weed problem, wasn't there? I mean, there was no problem landing fish there. It was so deep. Once you had that take, the fish were way above the weed, you know, because it was 30-odd foot deep.
Yeah.
You know, there was, as soon as you came off the feature, there might have been 12 to 15 foot. You know, there's just 20 foot of deep depth below where you're playing the fish. You didn't really lose any because of weed.
It did make for a good scrap, though.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the jury's out for me. I mean, I would probably be a hypocrite. I like using, you know, the short, like, 2-3 foot leaders that you buy ready-made. I actually use that, what's it called now? Nash do it, I'm sure these are the companies, but it's basically lead core without the lead. It's like a loose weave material. You still can thread down it, you know, you splice it and stuff to make the loops.
There's several companies do a similar sort of thing. I've got the Nash on my rod. Well, I did have it on my rods, and I can't remember what the hell it's called.
No, okay, is it just called diffusion leader or something?
Is their fuse leaders.
Yeah, they led the fluorocarbon coated stuff, isn't it? Yeah, I forget what it's called, but I love it. It looks great on the bottom. It just follows like every contour, and I only use a short length of it. You know, it's maybe just looking at my hands now, maybe 2 foot maximum.
Big hands.
Yeah, but it's great because I think if you do get stuck in weed, it will cut through it. You know, like, kind of the rubbing, it's not ever going to break the line.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I think we should move on, but before we do, to anyone, if you do have any doubts, ask a bailiff or ask a fellow angler, and hopefully they should help you out, put you on the right track.
Yeah, but long and short of it is make sure your rig can drop the lead. I mean, that's the primary goal. Because all waters are weedy now. It's something we can't really get around.
Have I mentioned before about what the sailing club have done at Icombe?
No.
It was that weedy, it was ruining the sailing paces, he just couldn't do it.
They've got the weed chopper.
No, they've put some mad green dye in them, it's like fishing in lime juice.
Oh yeah, yeah. A lot of the French waters have that dye in. Cromwell's quite weedy at the minute in certain places. I mean, there's certain pegs that people just don't want to fish, and they're some of the best pegs on the lake at the minute. I know Nathan spent 2 days last week with the boat and a weed rake, and he blew up his tractor thing. He blew up the lawnmower pulling the weed out. He had a few lads helping. They did create some spots in some of the shallower, weedy areas, but he's been looking at the weed cutting machines. The weed cutting machines are 40 grand to buy. They charge 500 quid a day. I know Marsh had one down at Orchid because he used to rent it out. I presume he bought it for himself because they're basically booked up. Nathan's been ringing these weed cutter places and they're all booked up for the rest of the year and most of next year. So that shows how in demand they are with kind of current weedy waters. A lot of them have got contracts with the EA to do the canals and all sorts. You know, all the park boating lakes have to have the weed cut because obviously they can't make any money on the boats going out in the summer, all the pedal boats and stuff. Our park lake in Blackpool's like that. I mean, it just looks like a carpet. So, yeah, Nathan was possibly looking at buying one and renting himself out. But they've also looked at dyeing the water. And I know Marsh now at Orchid, that's dyed now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It does work.
Oh, it definitely works. I mean, at Icombe, it's, like I said before, it's just shy of 200 acres. And a lot of it, when you're plumbing around, it is an aquatic desert.
Yeah, it certainly works. I mean, how much? I know Nathan's had a quote for his, which is what, 17, 18 acres. Yeah. And the quote for that was 5K. So Lord knows what it would have been to dye 200 acres.
Yeah, I have no idea, but it's worked. But the good thing is now, all the Canadian weed is almost all gone. But the eelgrass, you know, the grassy gear that the carp absolutely loves, especially early season.
Yeah.
There's a few patches of that, which is what I've been looking for and fishing to, and it's what I've caught from. Every fish I've had has been when I found that.
And do you think that grows because it comes up higher in the water?
It grows in the shallow areas, yeah. And it comes up higher. It's getting the sunlight and it's doing its photosynthesizing job and it's growing quite well. What I also found, I had a bit of a plumb around before I came home this week. So I'm thinking ahead. I'm thinking autumn. So I'm looking at autumn areas, seeing what's down there. And one swim that is, I don't know if I should say this too much, because there's other lads who fish there who will listen, but I did find a swim, I'm not even going to describe it, but there's some good depth out there, some good shells, and there is silkweed galore, and it is the lush green stuff. You put it in your hand, it's like squeezing some green slimy Rice Krispies, and you know what the best thing is? The fish are already there, because you smell that weed, you can smell the fish.
Good, good, good. Well, that's enough. I think we tried to keep this short. We've done 35 minutes and we've got loads of guests to come up.
We have. We've got to mention this, shortly mention this 47-pound common from Oxley's caught in the junior match.
Yep, that's a cracking fish. 47-pound common in BYAC Junior Championships. Ben Hunt has landed the biggest ever carp caught in the history of the British Youth Championships. Well done. Top angling.
Yeah, big well done. Caught on a zig rig, weighed in at a sponged out 47.15.
That's some real sponged out. Well, that's well done, Ben. And
big well done. That is a fish of a lifetime.
Keep catching. And let's move on.
Yeah, we're moving on to our guests. I'd like a welcome to the Carpcast all the way from Oklahoma and kind of like the middle of America, David Moore. How are you, David?
Doing great, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And when we look at our stats, our second biggest area for listeners is in America. So I think it's about time we gave a bit back and heard what the carp scene over there is like.
Well, it's, you know, I've kind of been involved with it for about 20 years now. And it's slowly but surely growing and kind of you know, getting headed in the right direction. But yeah, it's growing over here. That's for sure. That's interesting to hear that you're getting your second amount of hits from over here across the pond.
Yeah, it's interesting. We get like little scattering all over the planet, basically, with the exception of North Korea. There's quite a lot in America. And yeah, I've been to America with myself a couple of times, mainly because the wife likes that big-eared mouse down Orlando. And, you know, I've popped in the Bass Pro Shop over there and I've not seen a bit of carp tackle. So
we're kind of unknown still. And it's kind of developed, you know, kind of, it may have been the same in England 40, 50 years ago, that kind of that cult following where people that get into it and they just kind of do their own thing and enjoy it.
Yeah. So you're on Big Carp Tackle over there. And when was that started?
Oh, actually, this will be our 10-year anniversary this month.
Oh, happy birthday.
Started in. Well, thank you. And now we're just chugging along, and you know, a lot of people still buy a tackle from England, but we're trying to fill the niche over here as best we can.
I would say that must come with its own problems. I was just having a look at your website, and I was quite surprised. I recognise just about all the brands you sell. It's the same as what we have over here, your Nash, your Fox, Daiwa, etc. So is that... Is there problems getting that over there, or...?
Well, you know, shipping's just ridiculous. And then we have our issues of dealing with U.S. Customs, who seem to be... I think what happens with U.S. Customs, a lot of the guys are fishermen. And so they just want to open it up and have a look at it and see what it is. At least that's what I'm starting to think anyway, because you'd think after 10 years of shipping it over here, they'd kind of go, okay, this guy's good. You know, we probably don't need to look at everything he sends over. But it is what it is.
Yeah, as long as it's all getting there in one piece, I suppose.
Yeah, most of the time. We have a guy that has a small independent shipping company there in Kent, and he's been doing our shipping since we started, and he does a great job. So we've been fortunate in that sense.
Yeah, that's got to have been a bit of a leap of faith setting up a carp shop over in America.
Well, yes and no. You know, I started carp fishing myself probably, 92, 93. I can actually, you know, listen to some of your podcasts. It's funny listening to it because I can remember when catching a 40 in England was a big deal. So, you know, and now, well, you know, the 50s and it is, you're right. Yeah. But I remember when it was like a mega big deal when somebody got a 40.
Yeah, I know what you mean. On a national level, it's not. Personally, I think it's amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, it's been around a while, and, you know, I kind of met some guys in the industry, a few of them, you know, that you've already interviewed, and just kept kind of coming back up in discussions was, you know, why don't you get involved in this? I was pretty hesitant early on because, you know, once you get in the tackle business, you don't get in it so you can go fishing, that's for sure. So, you know, it cuts into your fishing time considerably. But anyway, just, you know, it kept coming up. Like I told you earlier when we were talking, I was a financial advisor before I got into the tackle thing. And it just came to a Y in the road. You know, you only get one shot in this life. And I think my biggest fear not getting involved in the carp scene was, you know, 20, 30 years down the road really regretting it. So anyway, like you say, took the big leap, and here I am.
Yeah, so is I'm assuming with the size of America, a lot of your sales will be mail order and that, and online.
Right. Well, I mean, we have it's kind of interesting. I mean, we're open to the public. They can come shop here, but, you know, it's like you say, it's so big. You know, we get a few guys in here shopping per month that know what they're looking for, but we're not necessarily open to the general public either. The people just want to, you know, come in and look at a carp rod. You know, they kind of have to know what they're looking for. But, yep, mail orders, the internet stuff's where we do, you know, the biggest majority of our business. And we really just deal with U.S. Just started shipping a few things to Canada, but the exchange rate on that's kind of set us back a little bit. You know, that's another thing people forget. Dealing country to country is you have to deal with some of those hurdles as well.
Yeah. Another thing I noticed on your website, you're getting some of the same baits that we have over here. Is there any problems importing that sort of thing? You know, foodstuffs.
Well, it's...
That tells me there is.
it's ridiculous, really. I mean, you know, that's just people in the government. We get, you know, they have a one-size-fits-all. So we deal with the same rules as if we were importing food or, you know, like cattle feed or chicken feed to feed chickens, to feed people. And, you know, we're dealing with recreational fishing bait. So it's quite silly, really. But, yeah, it's kind of a pain. And, you know, the one company we're dealing with right now, CC Moore, they're fortunately very patient and they do what we need. And then we got some other companies we're working with on it. Yeah, it's the bait's the biggest issue. Tackle's not so bad. But the bait, yeah, it's kind of a pain.
Yeah. Is there any American companies started rolling their own boilies yet?
Yeah, there's a couple over here, and they both seem to be located up in Chicago. But yeah, you know, that's taken off over here, obviously, because, you know, it is hard to get bait over here, and they do some good bait. So yeah, we're fortunate in that sense that we do have some choices.
Yeah, that's good. I say, if anyone rolling their own boilies, because I work in a tackle shop in England, and it comes up in conversation every now and then, and a lot of the time, you point people towards the internet and YouTube. You know, there's instructions for everything on YouTube. I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I've seen on the internet, Well, you actually gave me the link for this list of the world's top 20 anglers. How did you make it on there?
Yeah, just, you know, so you're wanting some better background. Actually, that was probably on the internet before a year or two before a friend of mine sent me a link and said, hey, have you ever seen this? And I was, you know, kind of taken aback. And no, I hadn't. And I'm not even sure. I don't even think I know the person that wrote it. I'm pretty sure it wasn't just fishing skills that put me on that list. But, you know, it was also just the fact of kind of pushing the envelope over here on carp fishing itself. But, you know, there's some great names on there that far better anglers than I am. That's for sure.
Yeah, I've got to be honest. I've not actually looked any further on the list, but I think I will do now.
Yeah. Terry Hearn's on there, so that.
Oh well, that's,
you know, that says a lot right there.
Yeah, yeah. That's good, you know, company. You know, he's sort of on the podcast sooner or later as well.
Yeah, I've had the pleasure of meeting him one time in a parking lot at the. I believe it was at the Five Lakes show, probably in like 2004. And he was not a happy camper because he had to pull off of a lake to go to the show. But seems like a really nice guy.
Yeah, yeah, by all accounts. So Jamie Fish Yeatley on the Carpath Lake at the same time as Terry. And he's one of those people, everyone knows who Terry Hearn is, and you never heard anyone slating him. You know, everyone's got good stories about the fella.
Yeah, he's... He's definitely a good ambassador for the sport, I would think. Definitely.
Yeah, something we definitely need. And it gets me on to another scene you're involved in over there, the match fishing carp scene.
I know there's some guys that do it. To be honest, I mean, me personally, and, you know, it's more the specimen side of things that... seem to have taken off over here. I know there are some guys that do the match fishing stuff as well, though.
Yeah. Oh, I've got a list. It was, you remember Team USA at the World Championships in Romania in 99 and 2002?
Yeah. Yeah. Going back a ways on that.
Yeah.
Back when, yeah, you know, that goes back to just meeting some guys early on. You know, one that sticks in my mind is Steve Briggs. Met him in 99.
He's another lovely guy.
Sir. He is. I tell you, I had just met him, and he had been fishing the lake, obviously, and I was totally clueless what I was getting into at that time. And very patient, you know, asking loads of questions, and he just answered them all. Just, yeah. And I've ran into Steve a few times since then, and he's a great guy. No doubt about that.
Yeah. I only really met Steve couple of years back at one of the shows over here, because, you know, we were both on the Nash stand and just had a chat there. And you know, it's always a nice fellow when it's the first time you speak to him and it's like you've known him for 10 years, you're just chatting away that well.
Yeah, exactly.
He's one of them.
Exactly. And the trip in 99 to Sarah Lestie fishing over there, that was one thing that stuck in my mind. The French guy, it didn't matter what country people were from, even though you didn't speak the same language. Once you talk to them for a while, that's the one thing in carp fishing I've always noticed, is after you start talking to somebody, it's exactly like that. It's like you've known them for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, save on, you know, I've got friends who, I'll tell you a story about the first time I met Jamie. I walked away thinking, what a bloody idiot. But he'd having a chat, getting on really well. He was filling his stove up with unleaded petrol, spilt it all over his hands. And decided that he didn't wash his hands or rinse him in water, decided to burn it off with a lighter. Yeah, well, we've been good friends ever since.
Yeah, there you go. That's a new way of, you know,
yeah, I'm
just,
sure
let's just burn the fuel off. Let's not wash it off. Let's just burn it off to get rid of it. That's great.
You mentioned you know, chasing the big carp over there. Is that you know, your passion now, trying to hunt down the larger specimens?
Yeah, I've kind of, on my bucket list, set up a goal to catch a 30-pound carp in all the lower 48 states and Washington, D.C., so that'll be 49 places. And so far, I think I've knocked out 8 or 9 of the states, so I've still got quite a ways to go, but... Yeah, that's, you know, I've kind of put the traveling overseas, which I love, on a back burner just to focus on that goal, you know, for the for the time being.
Yeah, that's some goal. And are carp that widespread in America?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned Orlando. South Florida is one of the only places I know. I don't think there are common carp in that area. An hour or so north of Orlando on the St. John's River, there are carp in that area. Florida is one state I have caught a 30-pound carp in the panhandle of Florida on the Apalachicola River. So, but yeah, they're pretty wide. You know, most people don't know they were brought over back in probably the 1850s, 1860s. You know, carp have been here. We consider them naturalized. Well, those of us that like carp consider them naturalized at this point because they've been here a long time. So, you know, unfortunately, they call the Asian carp as well. So, and we're dealing with those now, you know, trying to take over some areas. But carp have kind of gotten a bad rep.
Yeah. Is that the ones, the mad ones that jump out of the water when there's a boat?
Right.
Coming?
Yeah, the silver carp. That looks... Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, the silver carp.
Yeah, that doesn't look like... well, it's fun to watch, but I can't imagine ticking one of them in the face.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous, really. But yeah, you know, that's the bad publicity carp. But unfortunately, you know, you mentioned carp and grass carp, common carp, Asian carp kind of get, you know, all lumped in together. So
yeah.
We're trying to educate people on that. But, yeah, you know, Southern Florida is really the only place I can think of there aren't carp.
Yeah. When you mentioned that about 100 miles north of Orlando, I'm glad we're recording this. My wife today has actually booked a holiday later this year, going back doing all the Disneyland thing. So right. I might take a day out to catch a carp.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I have a good friend in Orlando. Actually talked about trying to get some investors together to put a carp, just build a carp lake in the Orlando area just for that. Cause I'm sure it'd be busy with all the people that go from Europe over to Disney World there. So it's funny that you mentioned that.
Yeah. I think anything in that area of the world will be busy cause we've been several times. My wife's Mickey Mouse mad and you know, I like it as well. I mean, we're going in awesome. So we're coinciding with the Halloween Horror Nights, which, that's right up my street, that sort of thing.
There you go. No, it's a fun area, no doubt about that. Yeah. And it's a little bit hot for me. I went to ICAST, which is a tackle trade show, a couple years ago, and after that I did the whole Disney World thing with the wife and kids, and man, by noon you're ready to go sit in the air conditioning.
Yeah. Definitely. Give me about 10 o'clock in the morning. When we used to have dull and rainy British weather, walking around in 30, 35 degrees heat all day.
Yeah.
I'm just getting away from carp slightly. What I saw last time I was over there, we'd come out of the Hollywood Studios park and we're queuing up to catch the boats down to the boardwalk area. I'm just looking off the jetty. And there's a bunch of fish down there. I'm not sure what they were, and a couple of turtles. And then all of a sudden, this other lungfish just darted in from the side and grabbed one of these, I don't know, the crappies or something like that. And I watched thinking, what the hell was that? And I got a look at this other fish again. And I'm not an expert, but I'm pretty sure I was watching a snakehead.
Could have been. I believe those are down there. It could have been a gar. Could have been a natural fish. I don't know if they're in that part over here. It's very similar to snakeheads, called a bowfin that we have. So, yeah.
Yeah, when I've watched the River Monsters program on snakeheads, you think, ooh, you can call them vermin, but what am I catching one?
Yeah, there's a few guys that, you know, the carp fish that are the multi-species guys that catch them, and they say they do put up a pretty good fight.
Yeah. When you mentioned carp being naturalized, I'm sure, yeah, with a network of lakes down there that, snakeheads are led the same way because you can't get rid of them all.
It's unfortunate, really. You know, carp are just so hardy that, and people don't fish for them. You know, when there gets to be an overpopulation of carp, you know, in my opinion, most of the time due to poor fisheries management, you know, carp are cast out the, you know, that's the reason the fishing's bad, because of the carp. And you know, like you're talking, people have removed all the predatorial fish and they just haven't really been managed like they should have been.
Carp of the scapegoat.
Yeah, exactly. But that's changing. I've noticed, you know, being around for 20 so years now, in the last 5 years, I think, you know, we're kind of turning the corner on that, I believe. And, you know, one thing I've told these fisheries guys, you know, they spend millions of dollars restocking trout and bass. And you know, I tell them, I go, well, you have a resource here, you know, the carp that you don't have to spend a dime on them, you know, and they're fun to catch. So, you know, why not, rather than tell people how bad they are, why don't you promote them in a positive light and get people out fishing for them? Yeah, so I think they're starting to see that.
Yeah, I say they're a damn hard fighting fish as well. Plus, you know, multiple captures doesn't seem to do them any harm. As long as they're looked after on the bank, they go back and they get bigger.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, growing up here in the part of the country I'm in, bass fishing's huge, as you know.
Yeah.
And I was out on the water every day bass fishing. And then I just kind of, as a joke, a guy asked me about carp fishing. And I tried it, and for a few years I still did both. But once I caught my first 20-pound carp, I don't think I've touched a bass rod since. You know, and that was probably in the mid-90s. It just ruined me because they fight so hard and just gnaw some fish.
But all the carp you got over there, they've got to be well, from the pictures I've seen, you know, long, lean, wild-looking commons. They just look like fighting machines.
Mirrors over here early on were very special because they were rare, but we're starting to find more and more waters that contain a lot of mirrors, so that's been kind of cool, you know, things that new waters that have shown up, you know, pioneering stuff over here in the last 5 or so years as well.
Yeah, I bet there's so much pioneering to do. I dare say you've only just scratching the surface with the potential of the carp lakes out there.
Absolutely. You know, we found some really nice places, and that's actually probably my favorite part of the whole carp fishing thing is just the adventure of it, of going to new places and trying to find fish and, you know, figure out where they're at. And, you know, sometimes it's very frustrating, but other times it's extremely rewarding as well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I remember a good friend said to me a long time ago, we were fishing a low stock pit, and he said to me, having a brew one evening, that the longer it takes, the more special it'll be when you get them. And it was a bit prophetic. The next morning, he had a fish called the Mother at 41 pounds.
It's always one of the things about the English guys. I don't know why, but, you know, when you look at the magazines and stuff, and I hope you don't take this wrong or your audience doesn't, but it's like they have this look on their face. You know, they catch this fish, and you're like, shouldn't they be a lot happier than they look in that picture? Because they just kind of... So we always kind of, you know, just having a joke, you know, they got the sad git look, and we're just like, yeah, that's because they just realized it's going to probably be months before they catch another fish. So
I know exactly what you mean. I've probably got pictures myself where I'm holding a big fish and scowling at it.
Yeah.
Say it's because we're straining with
over here. like I said, it's just kind of funny. When I was just looking through ran across some magazines last night, even that were like 10 years old from like 2005, and I was just flipping through the pictures. I was like, even back then, you know, people look at, they just have this look on their face, and you think, man, that guy should be happy. That's a 40-pounder. I'd be smiling ear to ear if I caught that fish.
Yeah, they've got that ultra serious, ultra cult look.
Yeah.
I know. I do try and put a bit of a smile on my face.
But, oh, that's good.
I have had this accusation leveled at me personally in the past, like, you know, by my wife. So, well, you're happy to catch that one. So, yeah, I do try and put a bit of a cheesy grin.
Not there you
much,
go.
Because you just look odd. But,
now, the pioneering thing over here is just, you know, that's... in a way, it's kind of overwhelming because we have so many choices and places to go and so many waters that, you know, there's carp in there probably never been fished for. So, you know, if you're willing to go put in the time and you know, learn your watercraft skills and do put in the work, I mean, you can find some really special things, that's for sure.
One thing that I thought, because I've just done a couple of nights on the syndicate now, one thing I thought of while I was there, because... I just seen a fox running down the bank not far from me. You know, over here we have foxes and badgers and rabbits, but over in America you've got bears and rattlesnakes and stuff that can do serious damage to you. How do you deal with those? Or don't you come across them?
Well, you know, it's... Yeah, to be honest, I've never had any issues dealing with that, and I spend a fair amount of time, you know, out on the water. But I think they're out there, no doubt about that. You know, the weather over here, too, can get a bit tricky at times with the lightning storms and tornadoes and... So, yeah, we do have a few things that make it interesting, that's for sure. You know, wildlife. But, you know, I've spent hundreds of nights out fishing in, you know, wild areas, and can't say I've personally had anything. You know, we've had the one thing that's probably bothered me more than anything is a skunk, you know, that comes in and can spray you with that horrible smell. So I've had to deal with a couple of those. That's probably the worst thing I've had to deal with.
That's another thing I was going to ask about. Because I saw this in online, was it a few months back? Was it Bass Pro Shops had announced a big bowfishing tournament, which sold out really quick. So there's still quite a way to go with the educational thing. How do you...
I've gone round and round with those guys. We don't exchange Christmas cards or anything. I mean, we don't get along at all. But, you know, you try to understand where they're coming from. But, yeah, we're just... It really comes down, for me personally, dealing with them... on the trophy carp, what we, you know, consider trophy carp over here, 30, 40 pounds. And if they would leave those alone, we'd probably get along a lot better. But, yeah, you know, as far as going out and killing all the fish they do, and, you know, if they were feeding people or doing something with them, that would be an improvement. They try to say they are, but I'm pretty skeptical that that actually happens, to be honest with you.
Shoot a load and discard them.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I've been out actually fishing and have them come in over me where I'm fishing. And, you know, we have a shouting match at each other, but we'll just, it's just one of those things, you know, it's been accepted over here for so long. But, you know, we've won quite a bit as well, because on the St. Lawrence River, which is, you know, a carp mecca, it's probably one of the first places that really popped over here. I started years ago in, I think, 02, 03, doing what we called a junior tournament. I don't know if you remember Tom Felton, who's in the Harry Potter stuff. And his brother, Chris Felton, came over. And we got a bunch of kids involved in fishing. Well, now they're not kids. You know, they're adults. And the local people up there have really, taken to carp and are proud of what they have. And so we've kind of, through education and – and going, you know, starting with the kids first, it's really a lot of even the towns and the people up there, it's kind of gotten to be taboo if you go out and shoot carp now. So, you know, we can change things. It just takes time.
Yeah, that's a good plan, getting educating the youngsters. And as they grow up, you know, they become the adults that fish for them properly, you know, put them back, respect them.
Right. Oh, I was just up there a month and a half or so ago. It's amazing how you just drive down the river and see kids, you know, their parents actually take them out, probably similar to England, with their tackle and drop them off, and they just sit there for hours or even through the night and fish along that river. It's a good thing to see, that's for sure.
And another thing with St. Lawrence, I know there's several firms for England that, you know, run holidays over there. You know, there's got to be, a good market over that. You know, they're making the money out of the carp as well and the anglers.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's, I know there's still some guys over on the Canadian side that are doing it. Cause I just think it's easier for people to fly from England to Canada. The U.S. side, I think most of the guys have moved on, and it's just, the thing is with the St. Lawrence is that once you've been there and you kind of know it, you don't really need a guide. I mean, if you've got your tackle and that, and I know there's a few English guys that have actually bought little cabins or houses over there and spend the summer over there. So their friends come stay with them. I have some friends of mine from England. They just love it over there. A couple brothers, Dealey brothers. And, you know, we meet various places and fish, and they've been there numerous times to fish. But, you know, once they went with a guide, they're like, well, there's not much to this now. We just rent a car and go on our own.
That's ideal.
You know, I know some of the guys in England have a tough time getting their head around it, but just there's one stretch of the St. Lawrence that, you know, between a couple of dams, and just that alone is 100,000 acres of water. So,
wow.
You know, that's so there's just so much. It's just massive there.
That's a big cast. As far as,
well, and you got islands to fish from, you got areas you can drive in and fish. And, you know, it's just so big, so expansive. You know, it's fantastic. You know, it's car fisherman's paradise, no doubt about that.
Yeah, sounds good. Again, it's one of the things that's, well, on my bucket list, but then I've never even been to France yet, so I spent that much effort and cash, carp fishing, chasing some of them in this country. It's not left a lot, but,
right.
You know, I've got this hunt individual big fish out my system to a certain extent. I'm looking more at things like that. If I can find somewhere for the wife to sit in a hot tub nearby, then I can go fish all week happily.
Well, there you go. Well, I tell you, there's some beautiful places on the St. Lawrence to stay and cabins and stuff. I mean, if she likes to just chill out and read a book, she'd definitely be happy there, because it is, especially this time of year, you know, the weather's just fantastic there. But, you know, it's funny you mentioned France, because things were kind of, you know, back to the guiding, we're taking off there 10, 12 years ago. And I think there was more people coming over then. And then France just blew up, you know, with the rainbows and all the other waters that took off. Well, you know, you can't really blame the English guys when they want to load all their gear in their car and ride the ferry over. It's much easier than getting on a plane and flying over. So, yeah, that's what the thing that attracted me to Romania was back then. I think it was that 82-pounder that came out.
Yeah, I remember the picture of that one.
Yeah, in the late 90s. Yeah, you know, it's just the way things go. And over here, you know, I remember listening to the interview you did with Simon Crow, who's another good guy, by the way.
Definitely.
He was talking about, you know, just our fish over here aren't fed. So the ones you catch, you know, that's just how big they're going to get naturally. We just don't, you know, we're fishing lakes that are, you know, in the thousands and thousands of acres. It's basically impossible to beef them up on boilies.
Yeah, I suppose you just got to find the areas of passing through and, well, hold them. Make the most of them, catch them when they're there.
Just thousands of carp. And, you know, we're dumping 5-gallon buckets of maize in. And they'll move through, and a few hours later you can go out there, you know, with the snorkel and have a look, and it's gone. And it's just amazing how much food they can hoover up. And, you know, before you can get more bait in, they've moved on. So then you just bait up again and wait for the next time they move through. Yeah, that's true. It's funny. I know it's one of the places you've mentioned before, seen it several times. I actually bought a day ticket once and fished St. Ives, which was, you know, I thought, well, you catch something from there, that's a right result. So had to go for it. Yeah, I did a day ticket there probably in, I don't know, 05, 06, something like that. I think it's before I went over and fished the Orient after that, fished in one of the World Carp Classics over there. That was quite an experience as well. Yeah. So now I've had some good experiences over there in England. Great Linford Lakes, I fished that.
Yeah.
That was back in 05, 06, I believe, as well, when I was going over there on a regular basis. You know, and then I was lucky enough, obviously, having some connections at Fox, I got into fish there. Like, I actually had a 32 out of there, but everybody I talked to from England, they kind of snicker when I say that. They're like, not a proper one, but whatever that means, I'm like, I'll take what, you know, I'll take it. I'll count it.
Oh, that's just a big, a great big gray area when people say not proper ones or wrong ones. I'm sure it's something we'll, me and Jamie or whoever will discuss on the cast before long, but it's I'll say it's one of the things where some of the purists, they can go round and round in circles and disappear up their own backsides, basically.
Now, I understand it, you know, once again, but being from where I am, you know, a carp's a carp at the end of the day. Really excited. Luckily, you know, Max Cott has helped me out on that, so that's how long ago it was back when he was there. Kind of put me on the fish and showed me where to go. Well, I tell you, he's another one, great angler. Just being where I was in my carp fishing at that time, I could have just sat there and watched him tie rigs and everything he did for hours, because there's no wasted motion in it. I mean, so it's amazing when you get a guy that's so skilled like that in front of you. just, it's almost like poetry or something, watching them do what they do so well.
You know, those are good anglers, and you say, how's he done that? How's he caught that one?
Yeah.
And, yeah, you befriend them. They're nice lads. They show you, and you do it yourself.
Right. Well, and that's what's funny, you know, going back to the way you asked me earlier, the, you know, 20 best anglers or whatever. You know, I've been around some of those guys, and they're in a whole league on their own, and been fortunate enough to know some of them and fish with them. But, yeah, it's amazing, really, the skill that those guys have.
Yeah, I enjoy watching. I'll work at mine and, like I say, just learn. But, so we've been going for, 40 minutes, and I think I'm going to call time, because I've got to leave room for Dean and Ian as well. Yeah.
Well, you're always welcome to come over here. Whenever you make a trip, let me know, and I'll do my best to put you on some fish, whether it's Florida or Colorado or New York. You know, we're always trying to help people over here to come over and enjoy what we have.
Yeah, definitely sounds very tempting, and some of the pictures I've seen make it even more tempting.
We'll try to keep everything on the internet and let people know what's going on, you know, in the States. And one of these days we'll get there. It's just, you know, a market that's waiting to grow. It's just a matter. It's not if it's going to do it, it's when. But anyway, we'll keep chipping away.
You think it will get to a stage or just a year where it will just explode?
Well, I mean, it's manageable growth at this point. But, yeah, you know, it could be something like fly fishing. You know, the movie A River Runs Through It comes out, and then everybody's into fly fishing. Something could happen like that. But, you know, running a tackle shop, you know, it's obvious. We kind of keep our finger on the pulse of what's going on, and we get a lot of new people, you know, constantly. So that's a good sign.
David Moore, thanks for chatting to us on the Carpcast.
No problem, Mark. Anytime, you guys.
So now I'd like to welcome our second guest from all the way over in America. It's Dean Brooks. How's it going, Dean?
Good, Mark. Thanks for inviting us on.
I appreciate you coming on, and I also appreciate pushing the Carpcast over in America for us a bit through your, is it NACA, your magazine you publish?
Yeah, that's the magazine, but it's actually the Carp Anglers Group, which is... an American group over here of, like it says, Carp Anglers, and that's the magazine that we publish quarterly. So we do four editions a year. I started listening to you from your very first one. I've listened to podcasts for probably 6 years, 7 years, and it's awesome. It was a great idea.
Yeah, I've been listening to podcasts, not that long, but since I found out, like, Stone Cold Steve Austin was doing one, because I'll be honest, I'm a 90s wrestling geek.
Yeah.
Just listening to others since, and I just don't listen to the radio anymore. You know.
No, I mean, podcasts have replaced for me the radio in the car. I just plug my phone in, turn a podcast on, and, away you go.
Yeah, myself as well, and it's through listening to podcasts. I was searching for fishing podcasts, and there wasn't one for carp fishing. And knowing Jamie was into his audio production and has been a DJ for a long time, you know, he's a good friend, and it was a logical phone call to make. And I says to him, after talking his usual carp fishing banter, I says, mate, carp fishing needs a podcast. And he laughed. He'd actually already had the idea, started the Facebook page, but had been too busy to follow it up. So we got together in there.
It's been great so far. Especially listening, to some of the guests you've had on. Some interesting episodes. Especially like the Mark Holmes episode was awesome.
Yeah, he's very opinionated,
very passionate.
Forthright, passionate, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
I'm
sure he's someone we'll get on again in the not too distant future. He was a good guest. I also had quite a lot of notes and questions I wanted to ask him, but just didn't get in. On to you. You're from. You can tell you're by people will be able to tell by your accent. You're not a Native American. You're from Stoke-on-Trent. Right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm from Stoke-on-Trent. Yeah, I kind of came over here 15, 16 years ago in the summer to coach soccer or football, as you know it. Yeah. And once I graduated university, I got offered a full-time job, and I've been here for 15 years now. I'm married, so I'm not going anywhere. So there's, you know, there's quite a few. It depends where you are in the country. I'm near Boston, so there's a lot of expats around here, you know, especially in the fishing community.
Oh, that's good stuff. So you went, you started your carp fishing over here, and what did you find over there when you first thought, I want to catch some carp? What did you find when you started looking?
Believe it or not, I kind of stumbled on carp. I've lived in quite a few different places in the country. I was up in, out in Chicago, in the south of the country, and then up in Maine, which is kind of really far north. Never carp fished, never even, because I was busy with work, never even thought about it. And then about 6 years ago, I guess, we got a new dog, and I just took it for a walk along a local stretch of canal, which runs next to a river, and spotted some lightly looking shapes cruising on the far bank. And as soon as I realized they were carp, I was on the internet, and I've been fishing ever since. No, I was just going to say, I mean, my impression of carp fishing over here before I started fishing myself was, the only really thing I knew was the St. Lawrence River. I knew there was carp, you know, there was a big fishing community up there and lots of carp, but had no idea how widespread they were in the rest of the country.
Yeah, I had a bit of, well, I had a chat with David yesterday, who was telling me it's a lot more widespread over there than what I thought. Hell of a lot.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the government, it's a similar story of, you know, people stocking about, I think, it, you know, probably over 120 years ago when the government stopped carp for a food source originally, and it didn't really take off. But as you know, carp are very hardy, and they survive a lot of conditions other fish don't survive, and they just thrive. They went through all the major river systems, and, you know, in my local state, I'm in Massachusetts, I would say 90% of the bodies of water have carp in them.
Wow, that's a lot to go at. I mean, there's got to be a massive amount of pioneering to do searching out these places.
Absolutely. I mean, like carp fishing in England for me when I fished, you know, the northwest where I fished was lots of smaller places, you know, 5 acres, anything over 5 acres I thought was big. you know, and then you come, you know, somewhere you go, somewhere like the St. Lawrence, and the far bank is, you know, can be a couple of miles away. you know, so it's different and it is intimidating at first, but once you get your head around the fact that they're just carp and they're going to be where carp like to hang out generally, you know, as long as you have good watercraft, there's pioneering, but that, you know, the biggest pioneering here is to find bodies of water that have large carp in. You know, that's the hard one.
Yeah, so there's a climate just right for them to breed successfully then.
Yeah. I mean, we're in the northwest. We kind of, where I live is kind of it's similar weather to England, except it's more extreme. So we have, you know, more rain, we have hotter weather, but we have the seasons. And the carp definitely, you know, they definitely spawn every year. They survive. You know, and in certain areas of the country, they've been, I don't think they've been caught on rod and line to over 60 pound, but they've definitely been bowed to over 60 pound. Official, like the carp anglers group, I think the biggest someone caught was last year was 56 pound. So, you know, that's a pretty big wild fish.
That is a great big wild fish. I mean, not a boilie fed fish like we've got over here either.
No. You're talking most, you know, most 25 pound plus fish are, you know, approaching, you know, 40 inches in length. So, you know, as you can imagine, the fight's a little bit different. You know,
mental.
Yeah, the mental is an understatement. Yeah, especially in the big river systems, I fish a lot of tidal waters, you know, where the carp are very, you know, they survive in, you know, massive fluctuations in water levels. So the fight is, you know, until you've experienced it, it's hard to explain. You know, like my first experience was, I think, a 15, 16 pound fish that after the first 30 seconds, I would have said it was 30, 40 pound. Yeah. You know, it was mental.
Yeah, you know, with them it's been such a good, hard-fighting, sporting fish, only got to be a matter of time before carp fishing really, really does take hold over there and, you know, blows up.
It is growing, you know, slowly but surely. I think a lot of people initially catch them by mistake, you know, and they do have a bad, you know, they have a bad perception over here, you know, trash fish, invasive species, which is, you know, like anything, if you say it often enough, people generally believe it. You know, but we are, you know, I'm sure, I think you'll probably speak to Ian as well.
He's cool.
And he's done a lot. He's done a lot in his local state, you know, trying to change those perceptions. And it's a little bit at a time. You know, if we can, Dave was big in getting them recognized in the state of Texas as a sport fish, which is a first step to put limits and regulations on what you can take, what you can't take. You know, it's because over in this country, it's, with carp, it's pretty much open season. If you want to take every single fish you catch, you can do. You know, catch and release is, you know, in the minority, I would say, in this country.
Yeah, and do they eat the carp or do they just bow them and kill them?
It depends. I mean, Americans, I don't think, eat them. You know, we do have populations of, you know, Eastern Europeans, like anywhere, that, you know, it's not, it's certainly legal. So if they feel like they want to take them for food, they can do.
We've had that problem over here over the last few years, which is obviously very illegal, but waiting for the authorities to actually do something.
Yeah, it's hard, as you know. I mean, like, America's a totally different culture. You know, it's a hunting, fishing culture, you know, especially with, as you've seen, with the right to bear arms and all that stuff. You, to tell people they have to put catch and release and they can only do certain things, you know, is probably not going to happen. So, you know, we're just trying to change, you know, some rules. So there is some limits on what you can take, when you can take them, you know, so that you're not getting fish taken when they're spawning, when they're very, you know, vulnerable. You know, so that's the kind of thing we're hoping to change.
Oh, certainly going in the direction. But you mentioned the right to bear arms. That is one thing. It's obviously totally different to over here in England. But when I've been on holiday in America, you know, because my wife's been Mickey Mouse mad. So we've popped in the Bass Pro Shops down there and you're having a look around and there's all your, like, you know, hunting rifles and stuff on the back. And then in nothing more than a glass cabinet is like a great big assault rifle. You're like, what the hell do you hunt with that?
Yeah, well, you kind of pick the state there. Florida is one of those states where that's a big culture. I mean, you can go in the local Walmart if it's a big enough Walmart. You know, and as long as you're filling your license, you can buy a gun. You know, it's hard, you know, when you come from England and you know, the police only have, you know, batons, it's hard to get your head around it. But, you know, for the most part, you know, that I live in a, you know, kind of a nice area. So it's, you know, we don't see, you know, that kind of, you know, we don't see it all the time. But if you go to certain, like Florida, you go down to South Georgia, Tennessee, you'll see guns, you know, strapped to cars. You can have a gun rack in your Jeep. So, yeah, it's different.
Yeah, just seen it in the shop, and I have seen it in the Walmart down there. There was like a little fishing section, so I'm having a nosy around there while the wife looks at whatever. And there's like your rods, your reels, your lures, and then your 9mm bullets.
That's it. Well, you know, the thing with like carp fishing over here is if the key is if they see it as a money making, you know, sport, they will embrace it. You know, like that's the reason. You know, Bass Pro does have carp gear now, slowly coming into the stores, you know, but it's hard to compete when someone's buying a boat, you know, for $50,000 and you're just buying, you know, a couple of hundred bucks worth of gear.
I think, well, I've seen on telly as well while I've been over there, the like weigh-ins for these bass competitions where everyone's like got all the fish and it's in like a big arena with on stage. It's totally over the top. But
And the competitions, that's what, you know, that's another thing that, you know, is big. The carp fishing scene in this country is we have a lot of competitions going on. You know, I don't necessarily fish competitions myself. I don't have enough time and I kind of like my own fishing. You know, there's big money competitions. Dave, who you spoke to, has actually been involved in that. He's got one coming up, which I might fish, which is, I think if you catch a state record, it's a $100,000 prize.
Yeah, he did actually mention that, but after I'd finished interviewing him, so I'm going to be grilling Ian on that one. He said Ian's involved in it. Was it a
thing? Yeah, it's on the Connecticut River, which is a river I fish. That's 400 miles long, and I think they have about 150 miles of it where they're going to have pegs. And, you know, it's a usual competition. It's a big four. The biggest four fish you catch go to overall weight, which is another kind of bass. You know, it's easier for the American anglers to get their heads around it rather than just catching as many and weighing in the total weight. And the state record for Massachusetts, for Connecticut, is only 43 pound. And we know there is fish several pounds bigger swimming in that river system. So
there's every chance someone could catch a state record in a match.
I think, well, it was done. Dave ran a tournament in Texas where someone caught the state record, and the prize there was $250,000.
That is
so someone won $250,000 with a carp, yeah.
Wow. I think if the organisers of the British carp matches are listening, up your prize money.
That's it. I'm not a particular tournament guy, but $100,000, and I genuinely believe with 100 anglers fishing, you know, for a week on the river, someone is going to catch a fish approaching or if not bigger than that size. So I'm certainly looking to try and get the time off work myself and go down. It's, you know, $100,000 is a tempting prize.
Yes, it's a big wedge. Now, I know I had a few messages back as a follows on Facebook through the winter. I mean, you were telling me the winters are quite harsh where you are. We're talking minus 20s.
The temperature's different. I think it's Celsius and Fahrenheit is a difference, but this winter was particularly harsh. We probably had 4 or 5 feet of snow. We had a ton of snow this year. You know, most places have got at least 1 to 2 feet of ice on them. You know, I'm fortunate I have a little river system that runs 15 miles away from me that genuinely doesn't freeze, and there's lots of fish in that system. So, you know, you can go for a winter day and catch a dozen fish up to 15 pound, and, you know, that's a fun little winter session. But genuine, you know, usually once December comes, you're waiting until April before you can fish, unless you go somewhere else.
Yeah, you know? That was my next question. Did you, was it in Texas you went down, these buffalo carp?
Yeah, I went to Texas for a week, well, 5 days in, I think it was end of January, beginning of February. You know, in Texas at that time of year is genuinely about 70 degrees anyway, so it's quite warm. There's a few areas. It's a Colorado River that kind of runs through Texas, and there's, you know, it's dammed at certain places, so the fish are kind of in there and they can't go anywhere. And there's grass carp up to 60 pound, carp up to 40 probably, and then the buffalo are approaching going up to 70 pound. So they're, I don't know if you've seen pictures of a buffalo. It looks similar to a carp. It's a sucker fish, so like an overslung mouth, but they certainly like the same food carp like.
Yeah, and you catch on the same sort of rigs and tactics, is it?
Yeah, usually you have to use shorter hook links because they feed a little bit differently. So if you use a long hook link, it'll be back through the gills. But, you know, I was fishing method feeders, probably six, seven inch hook links and tiger nuts, and, you know, you catch grass carp and buffalo on those baits. So it's fun. It's something different. They're a very unique kind of looking fish. And
yeah, they're all like, all common scaling, similar dumpy shape to a carp. And I say up to 70 pounds. It's a good scrap off them as well.
They fight a little bit differently. They don't usually go tearing off, you know, like a carp. I mean, I don't know if you've caught many grass carp. Grass carp are, you know, you can wind them in and not know you've got a fish on, you know, until they get in the net. But buffalo, just, you know, you've got a buffalo on because they just plod around like a big carp. You know, they take a little bit longer sometimes to get in because they just plow around, but they don't generally make, you know, fast runs. They're not tearing around, but they use the weight.
Yeah, sounds like the lake I'm fishing at the minute. There's a couple over 30 out of it, and they've been like that, just slow, heavy, and you get to know, you think, you know, halfway through the fight, you know, dare I think this is another big one.
I kind of give up on that now because I've had fish. I've caught 40s that I thought were doubles, and I've caught, you know, 25-pound fish that I thought were 50. You know, I think sometimes that's the beauty of carp fishing, you know, and especially in the US, because you're exploring, you genuinely don't know what your next bite is. It could be a 1 pound fish, it could be a 50 pound fish.
Nearly 200 acres where I am, it's just, I go there because I'm unsociable, to be honest, and I can get away from people.
I understand that.
But now, there's one thing, I was doing my notes and basically stalking you. I was looking at all your pictures, and there's more mirror carp than what I expected to see from America.
Yeah, again, I'm lucky where I live. In this area of the country, we have, I think because that originally there was mirror carp stocked when they put fish in, they've kind of gone through a bunch of the lakes and river systems. They're very rare in, as a whole in America. If you go to other states, some people have caught thousands of carp and never caught a mirror carp. Whereas for me, the rivers I fish and the lakes I fish are, I would say, 80% mirrors, 20% commons. You know, and again, I'm fortunate. I actually love fishing for mirror. I like a big common, but I love fishing for mirrors because, again, they're unique, you know.
I love all carp, to be honest, be it, you know, mirror, collar, leather, whatever. But if I had to choose, it'd be a big, chunky, scaly mirror every time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm after one particular common that has been caught that I know that's approaching 50. But I've got the beauty is I'm going to have to wade through mirrors to get there.
Yeah, it's not really a hardship, is it?
No, it's not really a hardship.
When you say it's one fish you're targeting, is it a large lake?
It's a river system, so
river system.
You know, it's part of the Connecticut River. So I live in Massachusetts. The Connecticut River goes from through four different states, basically. It goes all the way from New Hampshire through Vermont, through Massachusetts, and then empties out into the sea at Connecticut. So there is a series of dams and you know, fish ladders where pretty much the fish are within, you know, a 10-mile stretch maybe. I would say it's similar to, you know, obviously if you fish somewhere like the Thames or even like the canal systems in Belgium. You know, the more you fish each year, you learn a little bit more about where the fish are going to be at certain times of the year. You know, and this particular stretch I'm fishing, I've kind of caught one fish. It's a 40-pound fish, and I've caught it five times trying to catch that fish. You know, so I know it kind of lives in the same area, so, you know, it's just a matter of picking. You know, I can't go out every week, so I try and pick the best weather systems, or, you know, if it's, because it's a big common, I generally fish on a full moon, you know, and just try and judge the weather for the best conditions to catch that fish.
Chatting to a fellow I worked with today was on about weather, because the job I had a few years back now, there's one of the fellas pulled up in the office, and the manager got his absence record and the horse race meetings and all the dates coincided, and he got his written warning. I'm thinking, if they got my absence and a weather chart, they'd notice all my absences were on a good southwesterly and dropping pressure.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm fortunate in, you know, the job I work. you know, there is obviously the certain. I'm a full-time soccer coach, so you know, there is times I have to be specific times I have to be there, but you know, if I see a weather system coming, you know, 3 or 4 days off, then you know, I can genuinely change things to get a night on the bank. The key is an understanding wife as well, who lets me go.
Yeah, I'm very lucky in that respect. And, yeah, she's brilliant. Just in case you listen to this podcast, she's great.
That's why I've dropped my wife in there, because I know she'll be listening. So
you've also got involved in the media in that Fox USA consultant.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, I've never, like you, I'm a bit antisocial in that I like to fish where I like to fish on my own or with friends who I like, you know, so I'm not a big, you know, go out and have a social with five or six guys, and, you know, I tend to, you know, not always fish on my own, but, you know, that's, to me, that's what I like to do. So I kind of dropped onto the Fox working with Dave, who you spoke to before. You know, and I was doing some helping him with his website and his Tackle Shop, and just promoting, you know, certain things, and kind of, he knows the guys over there, they were looking, and my name, you know, just got put forward, and I kind of looked out a little bit, you know, as a 16, 17-year-old fish, and I never thought I'd be in that position. But they're great. I mean, I that's why I started to write, do a little bit more, you know, online. And, you know, I'm editor of the North American Carp Anglers Group, which we got an article in there from yourself, which was appreciated. Yeah, I think like the media side of thing, I think like now a lot of magazines have gone away from, you know, printed editions, so everything's online now. You know, so we I kind of tried to make that transition a year ago with our magazine, and you know, so I enjoy doing it. I actually enjoy writing, taking pictures, and just you know, because it's, you can always look back at that in 10 years and look at, you know, look at the pictures and kind of remember the sessions.
You know, nowadays when someone who's read something you've written, you know, comes back to you, it's yeah, it makes it all worthwhile. But also, I dare say, doing your writing over in the States, it's part of the jigsaw to spread the word about the carp fishing and get it more widespread, put it out there.
Well, that's it. I mean, a lot of, you know, there's different ways to do it. Like Ian, who you'll speak to, is, you know, he writes, but he's also done a lot with his local state. You know, like my kind of the way to give back for me is, you know, I could write about myself and look at what I've caught. I try and do, you know, articles that, you know, a little bit more, you know, what I do, you know, not exactly how to, but, you know, this is my approach, you know, maybe a little bit blog style occasionally. But, you know, I have wrote for other American magazines that, you know, don't just have carp in, they have all the other species in. And again, it's just to try and, you know, get the word out that, you know, these are actually a fish worth fishing for and worth, you know, trying to preserve and keep them in our water systems so that, you know, they thrive.
Through that, do you ever have any events that you hold?
Yeah, the carp anglers group themselves, we, like, there's 50 states in America, and, you know, in most of them we have somebody from the carp anglers group who fishes, and we have state reps, and they run their own local competitions and fish-ins where, you know, you come and gather, you don't even have to pay money. They just, you know, and trying to get people in. We have events like, we have one in Massachusetts, that we run called Take a Kid Fishing, where, you know, kids show up and we show them how to fish. We have, competitions through the carp anglers group throughout the year as well. You know, we have one in Texas, which is typically February. We have one coming up in Illinois this year as well. So we have a ton of events throughout the country. Basically, it's similar to how the Carp Society used to be in terms of if you pay your membership, you know, and then we try and do things to, you know, you get the magazine, and then we also try and give something back to the actual, you know, paying public.
Oh, great stuff. It's, yeah, I remember joining the Carp Society years back for that, you know, very reason, and it's just a shame where they've gone over here.
It's a shame. I've heard, I mean, that's one of your podcasts where you were talking about it, and it takes me back. I joined the Carp Society probably when I was 17, 18, you know, and actually fished one of their waters that they had at the time in the Northwest, which was Farmwood Pool, which...
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and that was an interesting one. That was stopped with Leany fish, and they were 60 years old, and it was... You know, but I love the Carp Society. Then it was same kind of thing. Everyone was trying to help each other out. You know, I used to go to the convention, the conference down. I'm trying to think where it's been held at the same place for years.
Well, it's down now. Was it Dunstable before?
It was Dunstable. That was it. It was Dunstable. Yeah. You know, and I just, you know, I liked the idea of being in the Carp Society, and I think, you know, from all accounts, that has kind of changed over the last few years, and you know, which is a shame because, you know, I think it was started originally with great intentions.
Oh, without a doubt, and it's, well, I'm sure it's something that will come up on the Carpcast again in the future as different things transpire and come to light. Yeah, if you can replicate something like that over in America, which you are doing, that's great for spreading the word.
Yeah, I think it's, you're only as good as the people who are, you know, who are pushing it forward. So, I mean, I know a few of the guys in the Carp Angler group, and the only reason I took over doing the magazine is because a good friend of mine, you know, became kind of like a VP there and asked me if I would do it. You know, so it's, as long as you've got people there who are willing to put the time and effort in, I think, you know, it will grow. You know, it's, and that was at the time at the Carp Society, there was a bunch of guys there who, you know, were holding, you know, local meetings. They were doing the national thing as well. And, you know, I think there was a lot of people on board. So hopefully we can kind of replicate that here and grow the sport.
It's certainly going in the right way. And, well, I hope this podcast helps you a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, I mean, I don't know what the how people view America with carp fishing. I mean, I don't, like I said to you, I used to just think it was a St. Lawrence, and, you know, I didn't know that there was people over here with, you know, pods, you know, alarms and paying just, you know, there's more tackle tarts over here than there is on the lakes I used to fish in England.
Oh, you're not seeing them now.
No, probably not.
All the gear and no idea sums up a lot of lovely people, but like I say, I can't say anything on one myself.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I like having nice stuff, you know, that works. There is a lot of people over here fishing, and it's kind of like the style of fishing. There's so many different methods over here, you know, because, you know, there's not a lot of people doing the same thing, you know, so there might be, you know, there's another form of angling over here called pay laking that has been around for 60, 70 years, which is kind of like method fishing. Most of the fish over here are wild and have not seen baits. So, you know, that's one of the challenges we face here is, you know, I'm pretty much a boilie angler and, you know, just getting those fish onto the boilies, you know, sometimes takes a bit of time, but, you know, I'm probably one of the few in this country that uses them to any great extent.
Yeah, is that rolling your own or do you...
Like Dave, who you spoke to, has a tackle store. There's a bunch of different, you know, online stores that you can order stuff through, and it's, you know, not really any doesn't cost me really any more than it would do, you know, if I was buying them from England. You know, so I have, you know, all the major brands you can get. You can get, you know, Nash, CC Moore, Dynamite. You know, it's all readily available. And although I do roll my own, I you know, I'm a bit lazy now as I'm getting older, so. You know, and ready-mades have come on a long way since, you know, 20 years ago. So I just typically buy 20, 30 kilos and just use them, you know, until I run out.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I've not even rolled a single hook bait for quite a while and don't intend to either.
I used to love making boilies, but, and you know, you can get all the ingredients here to do it. But again, you know, I'm only going to save myself a few dollars, you know, per kilo. And, you know, I'd rather spend the time doing something else.
Yeah. Actual fishing, using it.
Actual fishing, yeah. And, you know, the carp over here, you're not... It depends, I mean, where you're fishing, where you said it's 200 acres, you know, you probably... Yes, the carp will probably know what bait is, but, you know, it's a big enough lake that they're not kind of fed on them all the time. And it's the same over here. As long as you're using a bait that they recognise as food, you know, you're going to catch them.
That's one thing I'll ask. Over here we have... You know, other species we catch, you know, there's nuisance fish like, you know, bream and, well, what other species do you pick up over there?
Again, it depends which part of the country you're in. Catfish, most definitely. I'll be heading up to the Seneca River in a few days to fish, and I'll probably catch as many catfish as I will carp because, you know, you've basically got to try and feed them off. You know, you catch chub, you know, I'm trying to think, there's no bream, no tench.
Is that the same chub that we have over here?
It's called a fall fish over here, but it's pretty much the same species, although they don't grow to the same sizes. Probably they max out about 2 to 3 pound. But the same thing, once they get over, it's like having a shoal of bream over you. And then the real one that you don't want to catch, which I do catch now and again, are turtles. You know, not little cute ones. I'm talking 40, 50, 60 pound snapping turtles.
Is that a cut the line?
Some people are brave, and if there's a couple of you and you know you want to do it, you can grab them, you know, by the back end and they can't. But the problem is the neck extends pretty much 2-3 feet out, so you do not want to get bitten by one. So I will typically try and get as close as I can and cut the line, and they'll get rid of the hook. There's certain rivers and lakes that I know where this time in the summer you're going to be plagued with them, so I just avoid them. I just don't fish those places because you do not want an encounter, a close encounter, shall I say, with a big snapping turtle.
Speaking of encounters,
but in other parts of the country, you've got alligators, various animals, you know, and that's the beauty of America because it's such a big country. Once you drive, you know. 30, 40 miles, you know, out to the river, you're in wilderness. You know, that you'll see ospreys, bald eagles, deer, bear, coyotes. You know, it's you pretty much see everything.
That was actually going to be my next question because I asked David about what encounters you have. Because over here we have foxes and badgers, but well, like you say, there's alligators and bears. And have you had any close encounters while fishing with anything a bit threatening?
Yeah, I've had a few. I mean, my closest encounter in England was probably with mink, which are vicious little creatures once they get into your bivvy. But I've not really had, I've heard bear, but not had any encounters with them. Genuinely, you know, as long as you keep your food, you know, locked away and you make a noise, they know you're there. But I've had a very close encounter with a skunk on the St. Lawrence River that was under my rod pod while my alarm was going off and wouldn't let me pick up the rod, was hissing at me, and I just, my dog's been sprayed by a skunk, and again,
as bad
it's
as
not
it's supposed to be.
Oh, worse, it's not something you want to get sprayed by. And, you know, there's these coyotes, which are, you know, like a little small dog, almost like wild dogs. There's a big pack of them at one spot I fish on the river, but they're on the opposite side. And then I've had a real close encounter with on the St. Lawrence with a beaver, where I was out. I was fishing. A fish got, not snagged, but my line just got caught on a branch, and I couldn't get it off. So I was wading out at 2 a.m. And my friend had the GoPro on behind, you know, just taking, you know, taking the mickey, basically. And this beaver that I knew was there, but I didn't know was there at the time, swam, like, underneath me. And once he told me that, I got out of the water pretty quickly.
Yeah. How big are the beavers then?
They grew, you know, this one was about probably 3 feet long, big tail, and they have, I mean, they don't have sharp teeth, but they have big teeth. You know, obviously they cut down trees, so again, not something you want to encounter.
Well, I'd like to thank you for this encounter, because I'm just looking at time. I'm going to save a bit of time on the podcast for Ian.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Mark, for inviting us on, and good luck with the podcast. Hope it goes from strength to strength.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And before we go, would you want to give your websites and magazine a quick plug?
Yeah, I mean, the Carp Anglers Group is just, it's carpanglersgroup.com, you know, and you can find everything on there. The magazine is, we're hosted, if you do a Google search for North American Carp Angler, we're hosted by ISU, that host a lot of magazines. So, you know, you can find our editions up on there on the website, and pretty much a Google search will find you everything you need to know.
Thanks again for coming on the cast. I'd like to welcome our third guest all the way from America to the Carp Cast. It's Ian Sorrell. How are you, Ian? A bit warm over there, is it?
Yeah, it's been up in the 80s and 90s for the past couple of weeks here, so I actually dream of being back in England and suffering some of the cold, grey climate that I grew up with. So
I'm looking out the window behind.
Too much of a good thing.
Yeah, grey is a very good description of it right now.
Yeah, yes. I can imagine. But then you don't get the extremes that we get. We get, we've had freezing cold winters and swelteringly hot summers. So, we get everything from sort of 18 to 20 inches of ice on some of the lakes in the winter, and 80s to 90s in the summer. But, you know, spring and autumn are just spectacular. Real nice. Really nice.
Oh, I bet they are. It's certainly extremes of the weather.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we get the occasional tornado, occasional hurricane, just to make it more interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd fancy being bivvied up with tornadoes flying around.
But, I've managed to avoid it so far. But we've had a couple of hairy moments on a couple of the waters, but luckily not too bad.
No, so we've all had some strong winds, but when you see these tornadoes and these F5s on telly, they're something else.
And when I talk about hairy moments, I'm talking about, you know, interactions with furry beasts rather than...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I've had a couple of encounters with black bears over here, which are pretty common now. I mean, you know, we get them all the time coming through our backyard. But
wow.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, I was doing a session, you know, into the darkness. One, it was probably November time, so it was. But I heard this animal, and it was definitely an animal, coming through the undergrowth, and stood up and shone my headlamp at it, and it was definitely staring me down. It had obviously got scent of the boilies and was.
dear. You're laughing, but that could have been quite serious.
You know, actually, fortunately, the black bears are pretty decent. I mean, they're you know, they grow to about, you know, 250, 300 pounds, but they really try, and you know, they normally avoid confrontation, and so far so good. I'm here to tell the tale.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Certainly makes the hairs on the back of your neck sort of, you know, stand up when you hear that kind of stuff. Because you know, I was quite a distance away from my car or any human habitation. So
yeah, it makes that hedgehog I saw this morning seem quite insignificant.
yeah. Just a little different. Just a little different.
Yeah, definitely.
But
So you're obviously an Englishman living in America. You're from Cheshire.
Yeah, but
in books to start with. Yeah, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, grew up in you know, the home counties, and you know, fished the you know, grew up fishing. You know, really, I think I started with a fishing rod when I was about 4 years old. So that's a long time ago. But you know, fished all around. You know, the Hertfordshire, Buckinghamshire area, Colne Valley especially. So I mean, the Tring reservoirs were a, you know, 2 or 3 miles cycle in one direction, and then, you know, buses and trains to get out to the Thames at Windsor, or you know, pop over to the Colne Valley. And you know, looking back on that now, I mean that was back in the, you know, through the 1970s into the early 80s, and probably didn't realize quite what we were sitting on in terms of the amount of fishing there. I mean, just extraordinary.
Oh yeah, well, just like Savvy, they're now stuff of legend, and you actually caught one of them, Sally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I, you know, as I say, been fishing the Colne Valley for quite some time, and actually happened to bump into, you know, one of the great carp legends, Mike Wilson. And you know, my carping success back then in those days was kind of limited. I mean, like a lot of people, actually, we were mostly all round anglers. So you kind of moved, you know, from one species to another. And, you know, so I wasn't a full-time carp angler by any means back then. And I bumped into Mike at a party, and we actually, believe it or not, got talking about chasing catfish. And, you know, we met up again, had a couple of beers another time, and he, you know, we were talking about carp fishing, and he, you know, I said, well, you know, I've had limited success. He said, well, I know a place you might catch a couple. And I think this is back in 1978. And that's when Mike introduced me to Savvy. And, you know, back then it was as a member of the Ruislip Angling Club. And part of the first year was that you were limited as a new member to, you know, kind of working your ass off on working parties and then going off and actually fishing club matches. And so I really didn't get to sit down and fish Savvy until probably towards the end of 1979. By then, we'd just seen the, you know, the real changes in carp fishing. I think it was probably sometime in 1980 that we first saw the hair rig. And you know, Mike came running down the bank, dangling this bait boilie off the bottom of a hook. And I'm like, what the hell's that, you know? And that was the start of the modern carp era. It was incredible. And it was also the start of the change in Savvy, because then Redlands, who owned the lake, opened it up to the new syndicate. Probably within, you know, sort of the next 2 years, it was the who's who of carp fishing along the opposite bank from where we were sat on the island, because the Rice Angling Club still had access to the island.
Yeah, there's a lot of names associated with Savvy and Harefield just over the road as well. It's, you know, the Colne Valley, there's so many historical waters in such a...
Oh, it's in such a small area. And they were all stocked with carp, you know, back in the late 50s, early 60s. And I was also, Mike Wilson and I were also bailiffs for Boyers. So we had access to all their waters as well.
Spoiled for choice.
We really were, and as I say, I mean, probably, you know, looking back on it, probably didn't quite appreciate what we had, you know, sitting at our feet. And but you know, when you had Savvy to fish, and you know, having seen Mike's photos of what he'd had out of there, which actually very few people had seen his captures back then. I mean, he was actually, I think, denied membership of the BCSG because nobody believed his captures. Nobody believed he could catch that many fish.
Did he get in there? Did he have to provide evidence?
I don't think. I don't know if Mike ever joined the BCSG, but it was fascinating because I think he got interviewed and talked about his captures, and I'm not sure they ever believed him. And Mike, to this day, says, "Well, if they'd actually asked me, he said I had the transparencies in the boot of his car." And but it's just incredible. And you know, when you look back on what he achieved in terms of captures of extraordinary fish, most of them 20s and a few 30s, but back then that was just exceptional. The rate and numbers of fish that he caught.
I remember reading his early stuff when he was writing. Was it the? It was Mike Wilson did the baiting pyramid.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the other thing about the baiting pyramid. I mean, this is pre-hair rigs, so Mike had started off fishing sweet corn, and he had deal with one of the local freezer centres, and he was able to buy sweet corn at very inexpensively because he's using gallons of the damn stuff. Yeah. And he ended up sort of losing the contract on that one. So that's when he switched over to maize was boiling up maize every night and dumping it in. But, you know, primarily he was side hooking it because that was the way you did it. And the classic is if you see some of those early photos, I mean, Mike is literally hovering over the rods for hours on end because that was twitcher fishing back then. I mean, you would never have a bivvy because you'd have missed every fish by the time you got to the rods. I don't think people nowadays probably appreciate that those early days where you generally had to sit right next to the damn rods to even catch a fish.
Yeah, that's one of the things. It has definitely, on a lot of waters anyway, have come full circle, especially waters, busy day-to-day waters, the carp are under so much pressure, they've conditioned to not screaming off every time. And I've caught quite a few fish. I just get one bleep, then that's it. The buzzer's done its job. I look at where the line enters the water, and any unnatural movement, I'm picking that rod up and whacking it one. And
it's amazing. And I really find it difficult to leave my rods for any length of time, more than a few feet, because despite the fish over here being as numerous and uneducated as compared to the UK fish, the number of times I've sat, right on top of my rods and had exactly that happen, particularly in the colder months when it gets the water temperatures are getting very low. Those fish, I've missed fish because I've just not been on top of the rods. I was actually fishing next to somebody who, I actually saw their line tighten up two or three times, but they never got a beat on their alarm. So I actually said to myself, I reckon you got a fish right there. And I saw their bobbin move about half an inch and then an inch. And I said, you should just hit that, just see what happens. And they said, no, I'll get a screaming run in a moment. Well, nothing happened. And I'm fishing the other side of the baited area. And 2 minutes later, I got exactly the same movement, maybe a single beep off the Delkin. And I nailed it. And that fish was, I think, 32, 33 pounds, which just goes to show that even with uneducated fish, they can... They're not able to to just hook themselves and run like some people think.
Yeah, that's good angling. Now, also what I think is good angling, is it true you once intentionally caught measles to get time off work to go fishing?
Yeah, that is absolutely true. Yep. Yeah, got German measles, and at the time, I think having figured out that if you were covered in spots, that was a minimum 2 week time off work, and paid. So it took every I was standing in a pub one night. And my mate said, "Oh, my little brother's got measles." I said, "Let's go and see how he is."
Oh, did you get there and give him a big hug?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because, you know, I think it's the German measles that you can catch, you know, time again. I think I'd had measles as a young kid, but you can, you know, you can get it again. So, yeah, figured that was well worth it.
Yeah. Did you catch?
So I sat in my... Yeah, I did all right, actually. I actually sat mostly over at Tring Reservoirs and chasing big roach back in those days. And because
yeah,
there was
a, you know, those and tench, weren't they?
Yeah. Well, the tench came a bit later. This was a little earlier. But the big roach out Star Tops were. I mean, it's one of the best places to catch, you know, fish. You know, 2.5 pounds. And this was probably. Yeah, it must have been 1978. And yeah, you'd fish 60 yards with a swim feeder and a couple of maggots or casters, and fantastic, great fun.
Yeah, definitely. So let's move on. Is it 1994 you moved over to the States?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, actually moved over for my wife's job, and we figured we'd come here for a couple of years and haven't been, never went back full time. So.
Yeah, you like it then?
Yeah, I love it, and but I have to say, I still yearn for you know, good old Blighty, and I was just over there last month, and it's still a green and pleasant land. I mean, you know, the only thing is, if we had better weather over there, I'd probably live there more.
That's well, we said we get the it's not great weather, but we don't get the extremes.
That's right. Yeah, it's I think it's, you know, I mean, I love the sunshine over here, even in the winter. I mean, even though it's freezing cold, you get bright sunny days, and you know, the number of grey wet days in the UK, just it's tough to go back to that, and the traffic around the M25. The thing I really miss is actually the mixed fishing. You know, being able to, I am desperate every time I go back. I really want to catch a perch over 3.5 pounds, because I missed that opportunity. And maybe a big bream, strangely enough, or a Wells. You know, there's a few targets I'd still have on my my sights.
Yeah. That's one thing with some of the syndicates I've fished, especially, like, well, I'll just say St. Ives Lakes. There's one or two people target the bream in there now. But especially in the lagoon, there's bream to like 18 pound that, well, when the fat lady was swimming around, were all but ignored.
it's incredible. I mean, I remember people getting upset catching, you know, big eels on Savay, and I was desperate to catch one. I never did. I mean, these fish were, you know, these were 6, 7, even 8 pound eels. And
it's a big old snake, extremely rare nowadays.
Yeah, oh, it really is. I mean, I think generally, you know, the eel population suffered big time. Maybe it's the otters, I don't know. But one of the things I used to be a member of North Harrow Waltonians, which was Springwell Lake.
Yeah.
And yeah, there were some, you know, decent sized eels in there. I don't think they get, you know, I heard of anything over 5 pounds coming out. But we actually had this dream of actually catching something like an 18, 20 pound conger eel and bringing it back and sticking it in there. We never did it. It was just like one of those pipe dreams. But I think that would have raised a few eyebrows.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And, oh, you mentioned perch. There just seems to be a boom in perch over here at the minute. And even the little village I live in, as you drive in, there's a river which is no wider than my car, most of it. And I've had perch out of there to 2 pounds, just a little 11-foot trotting rod.
That's fantastic. I mean, they're such a great, you know, fish to catch, and there's so many ways to catch them as well.
Yes, and we've got the drop shotting that's come over from America, taking us by storm.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the the fashion.
Absolutely, and you know, when I the very first time I went to the United States it was on business back in the mid to late 1980s. I came back armed with all the kind of little rubber worms and lures that they have over here, and I actually, you know, fished the Thames Weirs, and had all sorts of fish out there, including bream on those little rubber worms.
Yeah, I've heard of...
Just remarkable.
Yeah. Well, both myself and the fellow I work with, because I work in a tackle shop now, we've got simple drop shotting setups for the winter messing around, and he took it onto his local lake and had a £10 comment on it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I can believe that. In fact, I mean, one of the you know, talking about that, I mean, it's fascinating because one of the fastest kind of growth areas for carp fishing in the United States is actually fly fishing for carp. I mean, I know, you know, from my own experience, we've seen, I mean, on the Connecticut River here, we've seen, you know, what we thought to begin with was spawning carp, because there was just literally acres of them busting on the surface. But it was kind of like that. It was just too early for them. And it turned out that they were feeding on small fry, fish fry, you know, maybe one and a half inch fry. And there was probably, you know, I mean, it's staggering to say this, but I would guess there was probably 2, even 3 acres of carp crashing out of the water, taking these fry. And the fly fishermen up on Lake Michigan consistently catch carp, particularly early in the season, on little bait fish patterns. And the carp take them really quite aggressively. So I think that, you know, bait fish are probably a bigger part of carp's diet than we probably give credit for.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree with you there. I mean, as there was a picture in a Carp World magazine a while back. I'm trying to remember. I could be wrong, but I believe it was Mark Walshingham writing about his Ashmead syndicate. And he'd watched one of his large commons in there just sucking up and engulfing into this shoalless small fry. The picture he had was just incredible. Obviously, he's got his filter on. And
yeah,
he just, 'cause he's,
I've got a picture somewhere of, you know, a common just coughing up, you know, like bundles of, you know, fish fry. I mean, you know, because the fish over here really, you know, I mean, really don't see bait the same way as they do in the UK or Europe. You know, they're absolutely reliant on natural food. So crayfish, various mollusks, snails, and in the tidal areas of the Connecticut River, we have these blue crabs. And these things, I mean, a legal-sized blue crab that you can take to eat has to be five inches across the shell.
Yeah.
And we've had fish that we've caught that have been, you know, kicking out bits of blue crab out of the vent. And we're trying to figure out how they ate them. And a buddy of mine was actually, he's a fisherman, but he doesn't regularly fish for carp, called me up and he said, I've solved the mystery. And he saw about a 16-pound carp absolutely inhale a crab that was at least 5 inches across the shell. And basically what happens is these crabs rear up on their front legs with their claws waving in the air when they get, when they're alarmed or, you know, in a defensive position. And this carp got to within about, you know, 7 or 8 inches of this thing and just sucked. And he said that the crab came up belly first, hit the carp's lips, and then just imploded and was gone. So,
wow.
Just, you know, I mean, it really paints a very different picture when you see how these fish, you know, how carp can survive on all sorts of food stuff. I mean, I've caught them on big clams, you know, just the meat from a clam in the tidal areas. And so who knows what we're going to catch next.
You know, stories like that, it makes me think about some of these mythical big uncaught carp that we've got in this country and, you know, ones that are seen that are 100% there, but just never see the bank. And
I think that's right. I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, big commons all essentially becoming almost like, you know, predatory and just not even interested in angler's baits. And, you know, I truly believe that, you know, if we, you know, approaching these fish, you know, probably stalking them with live crayfish and things like that might be the way to go.
Probably, yeah. Some big hooks as well.
Yeah, exactly.
5-inch crabs up.
Yeah. It kind of presents a different baiting strategy.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder how many crabs you can fit in a spot.
Yeah. Well, the other thing we do is, you know, there's a fish here called the striped bass. It's a bit like the European bass, but it grows to 60 to 80 pounds. And, you get big schools of them when they're smaller, but, in the spring here, they actually run up the Connecticut River, you know, 50, 60 miles chasing herring and shad. So the anglers are fishing, they fish, you know, what we call eel chunks. So it's a section of eel on a hook or a fish chunk. And these guys regularly catch carp in the spring on those outfits. Really, really interesting. Really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Right. All this talk about bait, it brings me on to something I want to ask. You have a guest chapter in Frank Warwick's new book, Every Bit of Blue. On pack baits. Now, that's an American thing. What is a pack bait?
Well, I'd probably get shot down in flames by the pay lakers who fish pack baits by calling it a form of method mix. They would probably absolutely deny it has any, you know, comparison or similarity to method. But for people who aren't familiar with it, that's the probably the closest comparison. And the way they fish it over here is fascinating because, you know, where we put method around the lead or around a method feeder, you know, a few inches up from the hook, what they do with pack bait is essentially pack it, squeeze it into a, you know, a fist-sized ball around the hook itself. The rig's fascinating because, and it probably draws more comparison to something like a some kind of stiff rig or a chod rig, because essentially what they do is they take a quite a large hook. It's a one-aught or two-aught Gamakatsu hook with about a, you know, 3 or 4 inch doubled over piece of 17 pound mono. So it's actually quite spring like. And on the hook, they put what they call a puff. So that's a corn puff. So think of an overgrown sugar puff for people over in Europe. And they typically treat that sugar puff so it helps it to stay on the hook. And again, there's a whole science in how you flavor that and how that's presented. But effectively, that sits on the hook, actually helps to negate the weight of the hook. And then you have the pack, which, depending on the water temperature, could be anything from an oat pack to a rice pack to a millet pack. But essentially, for instance, the easiest way to make a pack bait for fishing in the UK is you take regular porridge oats and you want about a 54-ounce tub of that. You take a can of creamed sweet corn, not the regular sweet corn, but the creamed one, which is kind of got all the chopped up little bits of sweet corn. And then if you wish, you can add some salt to that and some flavoring. And then you mix it into the oats. And you just keep working that until it ends up becoming this stiff, tacky mixture, which you can squeeze around your lead or around the hook and form this ball of bait, this like method, which over here it's timed to break down within about 2 minutes. So much shorter than people would perhaps fish method back in Europe. But it has, for me, it has the same effect. It basically creates an environment and that the carp really just get totally engaged with. From my perspective, they're not so much focused on the sugar puff or the bait on the hook, but it's part of the feeding process. They get very active in sucking up, you know, this material in the pack or the method, and then they inhale the hook as well. Now, the pay lakers would tell me that, no, it's absolutely all to do with the puff on the hook that triggers the fish to pick it up. So I've probably got a lot to learn there. But I've used wooden beads. I've used polystyrene beads because I find the puffs are just too hard to handle. But a wooden bead on the hook works incredibly well.
It reminds me of what you just said about the carp sucking in a 5-inch crab. I've seen the carp suck in, you know, almost tangerine-sized PVA bags before they've even melted on the bottom. And I can imagine them doing the same with the pack bait, trying to inhale the whole thing in one go.
Well, certainly, if, you know, they try to, but really, I mean, that, it breaks down so quickly and it creates such a cloud of fine particles that I think one of the tricks is it doesn't really feed them in the same way as, you know, a big bed of bait, you know, particles or boilies. but it does get them excited and it does get them into a bit of a feeding frenzy. And you know, from the videos I've seen, they really feed, they start to feed very, very methodically. They're not rushing around looking for boilies or, you know, individual particles. They're just over the baited area and they're sucking up stuff, blowing it out, sucking it up, blowing it out. And eventually they just inhale the hook. It's incredibly effective. However, I think in the UK, it would probably attract too many of the, you know, tension breed to make it super effective. But I think people should try it because, we have what's called grits here, which is it's like maize, but bleached maize.
Yeah.
And I mean, you could use panko or you could use trying to think what the Italian version of grits is, but ground maize. Very, very effective, absolutely deadly, and you can put in your own flavours and other additives, and it works a treat.
Yeah, do they try different flavours and, you know, concoctions, like, well, pretty much like we have all done with our boilies when we first made them?
Oh, I mean, there's more flavours that you can imagine. I mean, you know, whether it's a commercially made flavour or anything of the range of powdered sugary, you know, drink basis for, you know, you can buy in the supermarket here. I mean, they all work. I mean, you know, I've used Marmite, I've used everything. It's just, it's, you know, whatever turns you on sometimes. I mean, it's, you know, you can just let your imagination run riot. I mean, I love using things like betaline in there. That seems to be very popular and work very effectively. A lot of the problem we have over here is if you use anything that's too yeasty or fishy, you end up catching a lot of these small catfish. So the fruit base, I mean, you get problems with fruit based flavor, but it doesn't seem to be quite as extensive. So a lot of the fruit flavors are very popular over here.
Well, that's something else I want to move on to. You've been involved in promoting catfishing over there a lot and even getting some the state laws changed, I believe.
Yeah, well, as probably you may have, you know, talked with Dean and David, you know, one of the issues we have over here is a very different perspective on carp by most Americans. I mean, they see it as a trash fish. They really don't see it as a sport fish, although fortunately, you know, more and more people are coming around to that. You know, whilst I think in maybe some areas, you know, carp do present a bit of an environmental problem, for the most part, a lot of the so-called science that has gone, you know, into, you know, proving that fact is, you know, a little shaky, and often I think the term trash fish comes down to the fact that people believe carp damage the environment when in reality it's more often human influences that have created the problems of the pollution, cloudy water, loss of habitat, you know, loss of weed, loss of native species, rather than the carp. It just so happens the carp are able to survive in those environments better than the native fish, so they've kind of taken hold. And particularly here in New England, on the East Coast, we really don't see any of those so-called invasive fish issues that I think they see out west. So carp here seem to actually support a lot more other species. A lot of the, you know, the sort of perch, pike, and other species do very well because there's carp surviving in the water. They can feed off the spawn, they can feed off the fish fry. So we don't see typically large stunted populations of carp. We end up with actually very relatively few small carp being caught. Just to give you an example, I mean, over the past 20 years since I've been here, I think my average number, you know, and I primarily focus on big fish, but in most instances, the waters I fish, I probably average 60% of my fish are over 20 pounds, I think that's largely because there's relatively few small fish in most areas. So we've been very fortunate that here in Connecticut that the state fisheries guys here, we took them carp fishing a few years ago.
Yeah.
And they suddenly woke up and went, damn, this is actually a really, really fun fish to catch. And we don't have to spend any money on it. We don't have to spend tens of thousands of dollars. stocking them in lakes. They're here already. They don't seem to be causing any real issues with other species that they can see. Why don't we make it more fun for people to catch them?
Yeah, and they're damn hard fighting and a good sporting fish.
Absolutely. And so bit by bit, we recently got a change from fishing just two rods to now being allowed to fish three rods. You know, there are still, unfortunately, in almost every state in the United States, you can take carp by almost any means, which includes spearing, bow hunting, you know, trapping, and a variety of other kind of archaic methods. But there are quite a few states now are quite keen to promote carp fishing by limiting the you know, the techniques to at least, you know, selected waters as an experiment, so that you can only fish for them by, you know, rod and line, and that instead of being able to take, you know, all the carp you want, because we do have a lot of people here who take them home to eat, to limiting either the size or the number of fish that you can take, and again, this is to sort of promote, if you like, trophy carp waters. So we do at least have areas where we're protecting the bigger fish, which is primarily what the game's about.
Oh, that's brilliant stuff. Then I'm sure they'll see, like we have on lakes over here, you know, the carp that's, you know, the recognisable ones, you know, they will be caught, you know, several times a year, year after year.
Yeah.
And are in good health.
As long as absolutely.
And looked after, and they keep growing.
Yeah, and the other thing, we, you know, that Connecticut was instrumental in doing was that up until probably about 5 years ago, if you caught a record carp, you would effectively have to transport it to a weigh station, to a recognized weigh station.
Which means the fish is dead.
Exactly. And so for most of that, us, that was just unacceptable. And eventually, it was actually a very good friend of mine, Steve Clough, pointed out to the state fisheries guys, look, the issue is you transport it to one of these weigh stations, and they typically don't have scales big enough to weigh a 40-pound-plus carp. So we persuaded them to allow us to use our own Reuben Heaton scales, get them certified by the state so that they're proven to be accurate across their weigh range. And now, you know, we can use one of these certified scales. And if somebody catches a record fish, they can call us up. We can turn up, witness the fish, take photographs, weigh it on site, and then release it unharmed in the water. And the great news is that we put that to test back in 2012. I was out to dinner with my wife in a local restaurant, and I got a call from this guy, Mike Hudak, saying, I think I've caught a record. And you know, we went down there, dragged my poor wife along, and weighed a 43-pound, 12-ounce common for him, which is the current state record.
Oh, brilliant.
And you know, to follow up on that story, we're now actually with David Moore going to host Connecticut Carp Tournament in October of this year, 2015. And if somebody catches a state record carp, because we don't have any national records, it's each state has its own carp record. If somebody breaks that 43-pound, 12-ounce record and is registered in the tournament, they could win $100,000.
Wow, that's a wedge.
We think it's going to be really exciting, and the state of Connecticut, you know, the fisheries guys here are really excited by it, because it's really going to put carp fishing on the map. And I, you know, we've seen carp fishing here in Connecticut probably triple the number of anglers fishing for carp in the past 3 years. It's been incredible growth. So we're very excited by the number of people who are taking up carp fishing. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that is incredible. And will you be getting any sort of, what media coverage will you be getting for that event? Will there be any TV cameras or anything following it?
Oh, I think as soon as the media, and we'll start the media campaign over the next couple of months. You know, David has that well in hand, but we'll have TV crews down there. It'll be all over the local TV networks. And yeah, I've already had a couple of radio interviews over here asking, because they've been fascinated by the fact that, you know, it's a bigger prize money potentially, or bigger opportunity for a record than a lot of the big bass tournaments over here. So it's drawn a lot of attention.
Also, been told you've got the attention of a couple of Brits coming over there, Adam Penning and Nick Hellier.
Yeah, so I understand. Yeah, David told me that they're planning to come over, and hopefully we might see a couple more. And we've got guys from all over the United States, you know, basically figuring out how they're going to get all their gear up here for a week. And I think the fact that it's a peg tournament, that it's the luck of the draw as to which peg you get to fish. We've got 200 miles of bankside to choose along the river in Connecticut, going from basically the Massachusetts border all the way down to the tidal section as it enters Long Island Sound. So there's some great opportunities. And the exciting bit is a record could come out of almost anywhere on this river. The chances of seeing, we know there are fish up in Massachusetts northwards that are getting very close to 50 pounds, if not bigger. And about 10 years ago, I witnessed a fish here in Connecticut that unfortunately been killed illegally. And that fish was all of 50 pounds. It was, you know, huge, huge common. So they're here. And I think there's every chance with, you know, maybe 80 to 100 anglers here in October, which is one of the best times to fish. We'll see that 100,000 being claimed.
If any of the Carpcast listeners are interested, where can they go for the information?
They can go to www.carptournamentseries.com. That's the website for that for David's Carp Tournament Series. Look me up on Facebook and you know, get in touch with me that way.
I've not got any holidays left at work.
Well, hey, do you know anybody's got measles?
No, there's a thought.
or a red marker pen.
Yeah, I think I might have tried that one as a young'un. Man, would they even let you on the plane if you're covered in measles?
Oh, no, that's true. Yeah. Got to watch that one. And it's not a bad deal because, you know, I think the entry fee is $300. So that's, what, 200 quid per individual. And if you want to enter the record, you know, to win the 100,000, that's another $100, another, you know, 70 quid. You know, flights aren't bad. You can fly to Boston or New York. October's not a bad time to, you know, for the rest of the family to go off and explore New England and see the autumn foliage. Great time to do that. So hey, you know, get them over here. I'm sure we'll figure a way to help out getting equipment through as well.
Yeah, that is one thing I was going to ask you that Dean's told me. I'm on holiday in September. We're going to be down Orlando doing all the Mickey Mouse thing.
Right.
Now, he told me you've caught some kois somewhere down there. Is that right?
No, I haven't caught kois down there. There's actually some guys who raise kois down there. Unfortunately, down that way, there are no you know, regular carp in that area, but there are quite a few grass carp. And some of those grass carp get big. I mean, like really big. So there's plenty of opportunities to catch grass carp down there. You know, I've had grass carp up here to, all I can say is over 60 pounds because they bottomed out the Rubens. Catching them on bits of bread floating on the surface is free line. Just spectacular fun.
Oh, definitely. Surface fishing is one of my favourites.
Yeah.
When you get a 60-pound Chernobyl chub sucking it, that's got to be an amazing.
I don't do it too often because, unfortunately, grass carp, you know, they're pretty delicate, actually. And they tend to beat themselves up on the bank. You know, they fight more on the bank and in the net than they do out in the water. But just to kind of pick up one of those occasionally and just kind of go, wow, I mean, they're absolute beasts. The first time I caught one, I thought these fish were between, you know, 25, you know, maybe even 30 pounds. And I actually, the way I caught it is there was a gap in the bushes and I kind of poked the rod through the bushes and then actually formed the bread around the hook and actually catapulted it through the gap in the bushes. Kind of figured out, well, if I do hook one, I'll worry about how to get to it after that. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw this fish and I saw its, you know, lips come up to suck in the bait. And then I was actually, you know, really didn't witness it take the bait because I was, next thing I saw was that its fin was about 2.5 feet back from its head. And I'm like, damn, that's its dorsal, not its tail.
That's when you realise it's a bit of a chunk.
Yeah, yeah. And that one went, well, I weighed that one. That one weighed 53 pounds. And that was just mind-boggling. I mean, it buried itself in a weed bed and I had to jump in and swim for it. But yeah, I had a few up to the last one, as I say. I mean, it just crashed the Rubens down to, well, they went down to 68 pounds with a thump. And, you know, so I just said, well, it's over 60. And it was an absolutely monstrous fish. So we have a few of those around. And we do have a few areas where you can, you know, sight fish for carp and, you know, whether using, you know, bread or you know, sort of, I think you call them chum mixers over there. I mean, you know, floating dog food and various pellets. And I actually like using the little Enterprise plastic cups, pellet cups, mounted on a hair, and then you can just stuff a pellet in there so it doesn't dissolve too quickly, and they suck that down beautifully. So it's a lot of fun.
Brilliant. And I'm afraid we're going short on time. I'll say on this episode is all the three interviews. So I'd just like to thank you for coming on. That's been really enjoyable.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Mark, and you know, hopefully we can do it again. It's if people you know, get a little bit more of a taste for coming and fishing over here. I know there's lots of waters to choose from in Europe, but you know, it's a big country here, and you know, sitting on you know a 10,000 acre water is not uncommon. It certainly changes your perspective on carp fishing.
Yeah, it certainly does. It's certainly whet my appetite after talking to the three of you and listening to it.
Well, maybe you have to leave the family in Orlando and take a trip up here.
Don't tempt me. You get me in bother.
All right, Mark. Well, it's been a pleasure.
Yep. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Cheers, mate.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing about the American carp scene as much as I did in recording those chats. And that is all we have for CarpCast 13. I shall see you next time.